Good Tuesday. Welcome to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you have joined us today. We have a fantastic program for you. Antonia Okafor is going to join us from Students for Concealed Carry down in Texas. We will talk about a Newsweek hatchet job. We will also talk about what's going on there at UT Austin, where a college freshman murdered earlier this week. Police arrested a 17-year-old a homeless teen who they believe was responsible for the crime. I saw a story earlier today from the Texas Tribune about a number of parents there of students at the University of Texas who are concerned about what's going on campus and right off campus as well. Apparently, there is a section right off campus called the Drag. And there are more and more homeless individuals who are gathering there, which means that there are more and more homeless individuals who are coming onto campus. And there's been an increase in incidents involving non-students, but the homeless population that lives around the University of Texas, Austin, who have been going onto campus, committing assaults, and things of that nature, not just against the student body, but against other homeless individuals as well. Texas Tribune says much of the complaining by parents has been done through emails to the university and on a little-known private Facebook page run by the university for parents. Although the Texas Tribune has not been able to access the site, parents have forwarded screenshots of postings urging a phone and email campaign by parents to area lawmakers and university officials asking for a better security plan and for something to be done about the Drag. That's the neighborhood there in question. One parent said the situation on the Drag occasionally smacks of an open-air asylum. One parent said, when something like this happened, it didn't shock me, honestly. I sat and I told my wife, I said, you watch when they catch the suspect. It's going to be one of these people that these parents have been complaining about. They've been complaining and been complaining for something to be done. So I had no idea that this was even an aspect of what's going on down there in Texas. It makes sense. You know, a lot of areas around college campuses, not necessarily the campus itself, but you step foot off the college campus, and all of a sudden you're in a pretty rough neighborhood. Not just apparently at University of Texas Austin, but, you know, there are no shortage of reports of Philadelphia college students being robbed, for instance. Temple students, UPenn students. Many big city colleges. Heck, you know, even, I mean, you know, Georgetown, pretty a pretty tony location. But even George Washington, American, Howard University down in Georgia, Georgia Tech, we've seen crime from non-students spill onto campus. Georgia State, again, we've seen students robbed at gunpoint in the library, but there have also been crimes occurring off campus as well. This is, again, a real issue. It's not a hypothetical situation. And it looks like not much of anything is going to be done about the surrounding neighborhoods. As a matter of fact, Gregory Finves, who's the president of the University of Texas, said, no, we're not going to restrict our campus. We're not going to close it off. We're a public university. We're going to maintain an open campus. He said he does not see a scenario in which the campus would surround itself with walls or locked gates. That, he said, is actually inimical. I can never pronounce the word inimical to a public institution. Apparently need some remedial language classes. So we're not going to see any sort of physical security in terms of walls or barriers or gates or things like that. They will increase a police presence, at least temporarily, and likely it will be only temporarily. But the Texas Department of Public Safety is going to be conducting a review of campus safety. Chad Dukes is going to join us later in the hour from 106.7 The Fan in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you've seen the horrible news. Will Smith, former New Orleans Saints player, and a guy who was involved in the New Orleans community both during his playing days and after his playing days were over, murdered this weekend in New Orleans. The reaction there in New Orleans, which again is kind of like one of those, it's a big city, but it's also kind of a small town in many regards. As you can imagine, the reaction has been loud. It has been long. And yes, gun control is coming up. Sean Payton, the head coach of the New Orleans Saints, talking shortly after his friend was murdered, said he doesn't know why we should have guns. Doesn't know why we need to have them. Talked a lot about the gun laws, got a lot of stuff wrong, unfortunately. Wrongly held views of what the laws are that were not corrected by the media. This wasn't a matter of opinion. This was saying you can go and you can buy 10 handguns online and have them shipped to your door. Not legally. Drew Brees, New Orleans Saints quarterback, talking to local press about the death of his friend. And he said, you know, people want to talk about, he wasn't specifically referring to Sean Payton, but he said people want to talk about gun control. And he said, I think you have to talk about the human condition. But again, in New Orleans, a community is reeling. And this is, again, unfortunately, not a new story for New Orleans. New Orleans has been a very violent city for a very long time. Just like many other cities out there, like Chicago, Illinois, Baltimore, Maryland, Los Angeles, California, we've seen an increase in violent crime this year. The real story is what happens when these stories vanish from the headlines. When someone who was well-known and beloved in a community is murdered, we see that focus for a few days. And then the news cycle moves on. And what changes? You know, again, gun control advocates would say, well, what needs to change are the gun laws. They would say this explains the inaction in Congress. But let's talk locally. In fact, later in the hour, we're going to talk about what's going on in Milwaukee, where homicides again are up. In particular, but it's not across the city. There are some neighborhoods in Milwaukee where crime's gone down. There are some neighborhoods in Milwaukee where it's perfectly safe, and there are some neighborhoods in Milwaukee where it's really not. In fact, there is one zip code in particular in Milwaukee where the homicide rate and the violent crime rate is through the roof. And it has been this way for a long, long time. Now, we're not even talking about the entire city. We are talking about a section of the city, a zip code. It has been identified as a high crime area for decades. And it still is. So we're going to discuss some particulars of why these neighborhoods are so hard to repair. And by the way, the gun control laws don't really have much to do with it. Unless, of course, you're talking about standing in the way of people being able to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. Jay Caruso of the Federalist joining us next hour as well on the folly of suing gun manufacturers. Hillary Clinton, you know, has been really going after Bernie Sanders hard in New York State. She's lost, what, 8 of the last primaries, last 8 straight, in caucuses, I should say, as well. All while she has been, you know, beating the anti-gun drum. But apparently she thinks it's going to work better in New York State than it did in Wyoming or Iowa or New Hampshire, all the other states where she's been really promoting. Wisconsin, even, was another state where she was really promoting her anti-gun bona fides. Yeah, there's another state that Bernie Sanders ended up picking up. But now Hillary Clinton is just kind of, I don't think this is her, but her campaign apparently just has decided, let's just make it up. Make it up as we go along. We talked a little bit yesterday about Hillary Clinton's comments about Vermont being one of the highest suppliers of guns used in crime in New York State. And it's because, obviously, because, you know, Vermont's gun laws are horrible. 55 firearms recovered in New York State in 2014 that were originally sold in Vermont. 55. Almost 1,400 firearms recovered in New York State that were traced back to an original sale in New York State. But you don't hear Hillary Clinton talking about the gun laws in New York. Hillary Clinton has also been going after Bernie Sanders and gun owners and gun manufacturers and the NRA and anybody else you can think of besides the actual criminal. Talking about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, law passed back in 2005 that prevented these sort of junk lawsuits from being filed against firearms manufacturers. We've talked about the background on this plenty of times before. Anyway, we'll talk about this with Jay Caruso of the Federalist next hour. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum next hour as well with an anti-state update. Also, Charles Cook of National Review talking more about Hillary's comments on gunmaker liability. He says Americans are continuing to buy firearms at a record pace. He's also glad to see Jonah Goldberg noting Hillary's comments on gunmaker liability. Jonah's one of those guys, first time I met him, he said, oh, NRA, National Restaurant Association, right? Like, I don't think Jonah is one of those guys who is a, don't think he really grew up around firearms, things of that nature, but it's good to see him paying attention to issues like this. And the legal theory that Hillary Clinton is promoting is really, really audacious. Bethany Boer of the John Cardillo Show will join us as well in hour three. Her school, this is actually, I'm so glad to report some good news from a college campus. Her school is making the whole campus a free speech zone, which is kind of how it should be, I think. But that's good to see, because we have seen campuses trending in the opposite direction. And again, a lot of this is coming from students. You know, the free speech movement, which was launched on college campuses about 50 years ago, was student-driven, student-led. Started at Berkeley. Students felt like they couldn't say what they wanted to say, that their professors were too square and everything was too buttoned down, and they wanted to be able to speak their mind about issues that even if they disagree, even if the professors thought it was horrible, they want to be able to speak their mind. And here we are, 50 years later, and students on many college campuses, some students on many college campuses are now saying, this free speech stuff is overrated because I'm offended by what I've seen here. And therefore it must come down, which kind of, again, it's not really what freedom of speech is all about. You're perfectly entitled to be offended, and you can respond to something that you find offensive. You can speak your mind. You can express your opinion. But if you believe in free speech, you typically don't try to shut down the speech you disagree with. Again, refuting it? Absolutely. Arguing? Defending your position? Of course. But shutting down an opposing point of view because you don't like what they have to say? No, that's not supporting any kind of freedom of speech. And unfortunately, you know, again, with some of these college students and a few of their professors too, I'm sure they would be okay with that. Well, if that's what it means, then fine. Maybe I'm not so fond of the freedom of speech. Or the right to keep and bear arms, probably still iffy on number three. I bet that actually, you know, Third Amendment, they're probably still good on. They don't want to quarter any military troops in their homes. But the Bill of Rights, you know, it's not something you pick out and, you know, I'll take numbers 3 and 5 and 9 and 10. No, it's not how that works. feel like that ad, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. They're your rights. They're our rights. They were rights that predated the Constitution. They were rights that predated the Declaration of Independence. They were rights that predated the United States of America. They're individual rights. All of them. And the Americans who had the opportunity to vote on the Constitution, a lot of them were concerned that the document did not contain a guarantee that these pre-existing rights were not going to be messed with. And when you understand that, I'd like to think maybe you have a little bit different perspective on actually messing with those rights. But I could be wrong about that. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return to the program, Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry joins us talking again about the situation at the University of Texas, Austin. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Tuesday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered woman, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
You and I didn't choose to be targets in the age of terror. But innocents like us will continue to be slaughtered in concert halls, sports stadiums, restaurants, and airplanes. No amount of bloodshed will ever satisfy the demons among us. These cowards dream of inflicting more damage, more suffering, more terror. No target is too intimate or too sacred for these monsters. They will come to where we worship, where we educate, and where we live. But when evil knocks on our doors, Americans have a power no other people on the planet share. The full-throated right to defend our families and ourselves with our Second Amendment. Let fate decide if mercy is offered to the demons at our door. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Chad Dukes joining us a little bit later on in the hour. We've got more news from the Northern Mariana Islands to tell you about. Right now, Southwest Regional Director for Students for Concealed Carry, Antonia Okafor, is with us on the show. Antonia, how you doing today?
Hey, Cam. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you joining us. There's a lot of stuff to talk about here. And I do want to talk about the murder on the campus at the University of Texas, Austin. I know that this is obviously a big topic of conversation on both the campus and off campus. We talked about the Texas Tribune earlier in the hour with a story on how parents are responding to this. But before we talk about the homicide there on campus and how the campus community is responding, let's talk about this Newsweek article, can we?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so Newsweek has this article, Campus Carry Advocates Suggest Gun Might Have Prevented University of Texas Murder. And he's presumably using the Students for Concealed Carry on Campus statement, which I got to tell you, Antonio, I looked at the same statement and I didn't see where you or the organization said that. We're talking about, again, about an 18-year-old college freshman. She would not have been eligible for a concealed carry license. But you and the organization seem to be, we're talking about the security situation generally for all of these students and faculty and visitors there to the campus.
Right, correct. Yeah, we were definitely, you know, if anything, we're talking about even more specifically the policy that we feel that is flawed and that has to do with the policy saying that if you have a semi-automatic handgun that you have to carry with an empty chamber, if anything. So they kind of just took it and ran with it and whatever, and then they wanted to, you know, expose, and it was obvious.
Well, unfortunately, you know, we do see this. And, you know, look, what's sad, Antonia, and you see this as well as I do, and this is something that I really don't like, and I try not to do it here on NRA News, Cam and Company. When a story first breaks and we don't know what's going on, you will see anti-gun advocates. They will jump to social media. They will try to find a camera somewhere and go on and try to tie whatever heartbreaking tragedy is unfolding to their anti-gun agenda. I don't like to see people on our side do that. I think that there is some modicum of respect for the victims and their families that can go into it for even a 24-hour period where you just don't bring politics into it and then have at it. So I got to say, I thought that, you know, your statement actually compared to what we've seen from anti-gun groups. Again, it's night and day. It's not that you were restrained, or it was night and day. You went out of your way not to talk about the specific victim. You went out of your way not to, engage in demagoguery about, see, if we only had campus carry in place now, this wouldn't have happened. There was nothing like that in your statement, but you still don't get a fair shake from supposedly neutral, nonpartisan members of the media.
Exactly. It's kind of like the whole, without, you know, cursing, basically you're basically screwed if you aren't due and you're screwed if you're not. Basically, you know, we waited definitely way more than 24 hours. In fact, when it first broke out, they asked us for a statement. The Austin American Statesman asked us for a statement, and we said, you know, we want to figure out what's really happening. We want to know all the details. So this whole thing was breaking for, you know, at least 72 hours, and then we still waited to bring up a statement that had to do with the policy on UT Austin's campus. So I think what it is that, look, we're not going to appease anyone, especially the ones that already are in opposition to our cause, and this is not really for them. This is for students now and for students in the future who are concerned about their safety and the concerned that their campus prohibits them from protecting themselves when need be. And we want to make sure that at least our side is part of the conversation instead of, you know, having everybody else drown it out with frivolous opinions.
Talking again with Antoni Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry. Now, I mentioned that Texas Tribune story, Antoni, and I thought this was interesting because I've not been to the campus there, University of Texas. I've been to Austin before, but I've not been on campus. And the story talked about an area right off campus called the Drag. Are you familiar with this area?
I'm not. I'm guessing it has to do. No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not.
Because the parents were concerned. A lot of parents on this private Facebook group apparently have been very concerned about this for a while now, that there are a growing number of homeless individuals who that's where they gather. That's where they sleep. You've got churches that are coming and they're feeding the homeless population that lives there. And it's not that, you know, everybody there are bad people or violent criminals or mentally ill or unstable. You know, they're a population generally comprised of good people on hard times, but the campus is apparently seeing an increase in individuals who are being arrested. There was apparently a fight between two homeless individuals in the student union a couple of months ago. There is more evidence of drug use on campus among the homeless population. Like, this is something that has parents a little concerned about. And, of course, the suspect in this case, a 17-year-old homeless teenager, now a lot of parents are wondering, was this where he was living? And what, if anything, is the campus going to do about it? The president of University of Texas, Gregory Finvey, says, well, we're not going to close the campus. We're not going to have any, you know, walls or gates. That's not the way that we want to go. So at this point, you know, you've got a lot of parents, I think, who are genuinely concerned about the safety of the campus, particularly unfortunately, once this crime fades from the headlines, the extra patrols stop, and the problems still exist, what happens then?
Exactly. And I mean, UT Austin is not a, you know, it's not unique in that it's an open campus. When you said that you went to Austin and didn't go to UT Austin, I was a little bit surprised because it's pretty hard nowadays not to go on there somehow, even if it's on accident. So, I mean, and that's how most campuses are set up. They're integrated into these cities. I mean, whether it's UT Austin, which is fairly safe in general when it comes to other big cities, or if you're at Yale and you're in New Haven, which is definitely not known for its security. So regardless of what campus you're on, anybody, whether it's a homeless person or anybody who's a criminal, is able to access the same areas that you're able to access. And so when they try to make it that these campuses are these like little havens of security and, you know, it's safe, you know, you don't really need a gun, you don't need any type of self-defense because in general you're safe. Let's look at the statistics. I mean, you want to talk about sexual assault. Let's look at 1 in 5 women are going to be sexually assaulted and tends to be people that they already know. Or, you know, we talk about just what's happening with mass shootings, it tends to be a student that's already on that campus. So regardless of what it is, we're in the real world. We have to stop with this kind of safe space mentality, thinking that we go onto these campuses and these institutes of higher learning, and therefore we're safe from harm. It's not true.
No, unfortunately, it's not. And you know, again, you make a really good point about what people's expectations are for the security as opposed to what the reality is. The University of Texas Police Department Chief of Police David Carter told the Texas Tribune, he conceded, as the Texas Tribune puts it, that there has been a rise in the number of homeless individuals crossing the drag and other boundaries like Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard to the south and East Dean Keaton Street along the north, and being found in campus buildings or sleeping in classrooms and stairwells. So, you know, again, any expectation that you have that there is that physical security in place, that there are those doors that are locked, people, unauthorized people can't gain entry. No, that's apparently happening on a regular basis. And as a matter of fact, it's growing more frequent.
Right. I mean, even not even just that or staircases and, you know, areas like that. But I know on campus at UT Dallas that there's always been opposition to 24-hour access to the libraries because of people sleeping in the libraries. Like, it could be easily a student but it could also easily be someone who's not authorized to be there, you know, quote unquote. So we don't know, you don't know who that person is next to you or across the street. You don't know, I can't identify, you know, a 17-year-old, you just think, oh, just a regular student, unless, and of course it could be a regular student or it can be a homeless person. And we're not saying, you know, an anti-homeless solution, have churches that are feeding the poor. But we're saying that when that happens, if that happens, if you're in a situation where you have to protect yourself, then you need to make sure that you have the means to do that, whether that's a gun, whether that's pepper spray. I mean, pepper spray is seen as just as deadly or as bad, at least, in the eyes of schools these days. So those are also banned. So what do you have? What does a woman have these days, whether you're 18 or 21? What does a woman have on campus to protect themselves? That's the issue. It's about campus security? No, it's about self-defense.
Very well put, Antonia. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thanks for what you're doing down there. And I guess, you know, one final question as we get closer to August here, just a couple of months away. I know last time we talked about a number of universities besides UT Austin that have implemented their policies. Have we seen any more rules or policies come out over the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, actually, my school, UT Dallas, finally came out with their proposal. So far, so good. We have a little, we have a couple of concerns that we're looking at and trying to see if we can get to the bottom of, but looks pretty good so far. It really is still UT Austin that isn't budging on their policies, so we'll see about that.
All right. Well, listen, Antonia, it's always good talking with you. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll do this again very soon.
Thank you.
You bet. Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry, the Southwest Regional Director, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Chad Dukes of 106.7 The Fan will be with us on the program in just a little bit, talking about the murder of former New Orleans Saints player Will Smith and the reaction that his murder has caused here among members of the Saints community. You've got Sean Payton, the head coach, saying it's time to ban all guns, that the gun laws have to change, that you can buy 10 pistols online and have them shipped to your door. Then you've got Drew Brees telling local media, you know, he says people are going to make arguments now about gun control. And he said, it just seems to me this is about the way the human beings treat other human beings. Now, again, there's a pretty deep philosophical divide between, you know what, if we just banned all the guns, this wouldn't happen. And it seems to me that this is about the way the human beings treat other human beings. We will talk about that divide and which side the media seems to be coming down on here when we talk with Chad Dukes in just a couple of minutes. Jay Caruso of the Federalist next hour. Julie Gunlock with the Independent Women's Forum as well. And before we take a timeout, let's get you caught up about what's going on here in the Northern Mariana Islands. Remember, this is the last U.S.-held territory to strike down a gun ban, where a court struck down a gun ban. They still had it in place. You couldn't buy a handgun. Since then, we have seen the Northern Mariana Islands be dragged kicking and screaming towards a recognition of the right to keep bear arms. And I don't think they're there yet, quite frankly. Much like Washington, D.C., after the Heller case, Chicago, after the McDonald case, the powers that be in the Northern Mariana Islands seem intent on making it as difficult, if not impossible, for people to actually exercise their right to keep and bear arms. So they've decided, fine, we can't ban handguns. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to slap a $1,000 excise tax on every pistol. Every pistol that someone would want to purchase, you got to pay an extra $1,000. The average per capita income in the Northern Mariana Islands is $12,000 a year. and they want to add another $1,000 beyond, again, the ordinary taxes and the actual cost of the firearm. They want to add $1,000 tax to every firearm that is purchased. The Mariana Senate, by the way, passed the $1,000 tax on all handguns unanimously. All right, stick around. We have much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other, and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling right. a love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, oh, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 well, years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up next hour. Also, Jay Caruso riding at the Federalist on the folly of suing gun manufacturers. Right now, though, I want to talk with our friend Chad Dukes. He joined us earlier today to discuss the murder of Will Smith, the New Orleans Saints, former New Orleans Saints player in New Orleans over the weekend, and how the gun control debate is already impacting the mourning process, the grieving process there, both in the community and within the world of sports, and perhaps even the world of politics as well. Take a look and a listen. Chad Dukes, thanks for joining us, sir. It's good talking with you again.
Always my pleasure, Cam. Thank you for your humble consideration. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, listen, when there's a sports-related story, you are on the top of our list of people to call, and you know, especially because you are a gun owner, you are a Second Amendment supporter, and once again, you know, the issue of violent crime, gun control, is in the headlines when it comes to the NFL. You had former New Orleans Saints player Will Smith, who was killed over the weekend. You've got Sean Payton, the coach of the Saints, who has come out and said, you know, he's asked about this right after his friend died, and but apparently he's believed this for a long time. We shouldn't have any guns. We need to have a gun-free world. Why don't we talk more about gun control? He talked about people being able to buy, you know, 10, 45 pistols, have them delivered to their home online. A lot of stuff, you know, I got to tell you, Chad, I mean, a lot of the stuff, very emotional, obviously. But, you know, the other side of this, Drew Brees, these New Orleans Saints quarterback, was also asked about this. And he said, you know, look, I people talk about gun control laws. He said, I think it's about what's in people's heart. It seems like, you know, even in the NFL, we've got this a very stark divide here between people who want to try to ban all the guns. They're very anti-gun. It's not really about, you know, common sense gun safety laws for all. And people who say don't blame the gun. Blame the individual.
Yeah, and I think that you and I know that, well, first of all, this guy, Will Smith, is, from all intents and purposes, from what I've read, a pillar in the community down mm-hmm. there, and he's a beloved player, and if something happens to him, people are going to be emotional, and if you start immediately
Absolutely.
Asking the head coach about that issue, then you might get something like this, so I think there probably was intent. I would also say this. This is another example, Cam, of somebody that has absolutely no idea how the system works or the safety checks that are already in place and is just spewing information that is simply not correct. Well, let's just order 1045 and have them brought to our front door. The 45 was invented during World War II. All right, well, let's, you know, I take it with a grain of salt. The problem is that I, as a rational human being and someone that thinks you should be allowed to own firearms and should be allowed to protect yourself and that self-defense is a right that we should all have, I can read this and say, this is a coach that's hurt. This is a guy that's embittered. And there's no difference between this and my dog died of cancer. And I immediately wanted to go out and find more how I could donate money, how I could volunteer to kind of work against, you know, finding better treatments for cancer and mm-hmm. pets and things like that. He's kind of going through that process. The problem is there's going to be thousands and thousands and thousands of people that just point at this and say, hey, look, Sean Payton, he agrees with me. The guns are the problem here, when he's, you know, clearly in an emotional state right now and very much incorrect about most of what he said, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with another radio host, John Cardillo, about this earlier. And I said, you know, there's a part of me, look, I understand that this is how Sean Payton feels. And if you'd asked him, you know, let's say a week from now, I'd probably tell you the exact same thing.
But there is a part of me that says, you know, look, in that moment when somebody is grieving, when it is so raw, did the journalist, you know, when he heard Coach Payton start talking about this, did the journalist's eyes light up like, ooh, good, I've got a really good hook here?
You know the answer to that.
Right. So there's no way that a journalist is going to leave that out, saying, "Well, you know, listen, let's make for a day. Let's make it about Will Smith. We don't want to start the whole controversy, because now, as you say, we're talking more about Sean Payton than we are about who Will Smith was as a person."
Yeah, it's very sad. And I don't think,
by the way, that's what Sean Payton would want either.
He clearly wouldn't want that, and I understand him being in the state that he's in. I'll take his word that he's felt this way for a while. But to me, there's something insidious about that. And people would say, well, what are you guys doing right now, Dukes? What are you and Camden? We're responding to something that was said. We're responding to an answer to a question. I've never gotten in a guy's face, stuck a microphone in his face, and tried to politicize a murder of someone that he cared for. That's just not the way I'm wired, and unfortunately, we can't rely on other people that are on the opposite side of this issue to be wired the same way and have the same common sense. I do think that it's reckless to do this. And Kim Kardashian is the biggest flake and boob that I've ever had involved in my life in any type of media way. She's tweeting about gun control, and she's tweeting about how guns can get shipped right to your front doorstep. And there are millions of people retweeting her and believing what she said because she has a television show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, good Lord, can we not at least have some sort of recognition of the person that's speaking and the human condition, what mindset they were in when they were saying it? That's the part that I'm worried about, Kim, is how many people then just run with this without any knowledge or any talking points of what actually the issues are.
Well, that's the thing, because, you know, again, Sean Payton made these comments in the context of his friend being murdered. So the story itself, you know this, Chad, again, there's a finite number of words to this story, right? It's got to end sometime. And so did we get an explanation? Did we get the record corrected of, no, actually, you can't buy 10 guns online and have them shipped to your door? Did we get that in that story? No, we didn't, because that wasn't the focus of the story. And so you're right. The misinformation gets out there. And, you know, frankly, we have, I'm sure you know this as well as I do, we are just awash in misinformation these days. And it should be the job of a reporter and a journalist to kind of clear out the clutter, not to make more of a mess.
These people that don't know what an FFL is, that don't know what you have to go through to get an FFL, the fact that even in a state that has pretty gun owner friendly laws, like where I live in Virginia, you absolutely have to have, you cannot have the gun shipped to your house. You can't even have an FFL dealer have it shipped to them and then bring it to you. There's just so many rules. The background checks are there. It's just, it's pure emotion. I was listening, your producer Cameron and I were big fans of Howard Stern, and he's actually very liberal, but a huge proponent of the Second Amendment, and he was having a debate. Colin Noir tweeted it out about ammunition, and Gary, the producer's on there screaming, well, why does he need 1,000 rounds? Why do you need 1,000 rounds? And I'm like, you clearly have never been to a shooting range. You don't know anyone that owns firearms. Having 1,000 rounds for someone that goes to the range even once a month is perfectly normal. It's probably conservative. But to that person who doesn't know anything about it, that sounds like ammunition hoarding, because they don't have the basis of, you know, the background and what they're talking about to actually have an opinion that is based in reality. And that's what we're fighting against most of all, is that people dealing directly with emotion instead of dealing with the issues as they are presented to them. And that's the most frustrating part of it for me.
No, you're right. And again, we see this all the time. You know, you talk about the number of rounds of ammunition or the number of firearms that are owned. Somebody owned 7 firearms, Chad.
Oh, my God.
Right. including like 3 pistols. It was amazing. But you're right. We could talk about this the entire afternoon, because this is one of the big problems here that we see culturally. There is no attempt by the media, again, whether we're talking about the news media or the entertainment media, you know, outside of shows like Top Shot and channels like Outdoor Channel and Sportsman Channel, there's no desire to see gun owners as your neighbor, right? Or your orthodontist, or your nurse, or your doctor, even though that's who they are. There is every attempt to try to portray gun ownership as weird, abnormal, dangerous, and, you know, you really don't want to be around a gun owner, frankly. I mean, that's the message that the media is pumping out every day right now.
Which is ironic, considering we're in this new stage of, you know, our evolution, where it's we're accepting transgender people, and we're accepting gay people, and we're accepting, and we are expected to learn. We're expected to open up our minds and respect other people's views. And then it's like, okay, I understand that, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that I do what I need to do to be as accommodating as I possibly can be, and, you know, kind of let loose some of my stigmas and what the way I was raised or religion that I was grown up with. But if I own a gun, well, then I'm a knuckle-dragging right-wing war hawk, and there's no reason to even have a discussion about trap shooting, or I go hunting and provide for my family, or I live in a high-crime area and I want to defend myself against intruders. There's absolutely no open-mindedness on the other side of the road, and that, to me, has been incredibly frustrating, to have debates like this, like we all do at the workplace or with friends or wherever they take place.
Absolutely. You know, we've talked with Chris Cheng, Top Shot champion, and he worked at Google. And Chris is gay, and he said, you know, look, it was much easier to come out as gay at Google than it was to come out as a gun owner at Google because of the culture there. I mean, you know, and
of course.
And I've got other gay friends who are gun owners who say, yeah, my gun owning friends have no problem with me being gay. My gay friends a lot of times have a problem with me being a gun owner. And so the forces of tolerance, the tolerance brigade, really are not so tolerant when it comes to things that that they don't like. There's a lot of,
well, how about this, Camp? Put me in a neighborhood filled with gay gun owners, and I guarantee the crime rate is non-existent. I'll live in a neighborhood full of gay gun owners for the rest of my life and die a happy man safely. Outrageous.
We'll try to find you that neighborhood, Chad. One day.
Find it for me, please. Put your crack team on it.
All right, we can do that. Listen, I appreciate you coming to the program, sir. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and look forward to doing this again soon.
It's always my pleasure. Can I promote my Twitter? I'd love to have some of your listeners checking out.
Yes, please.
That Chad Dukes. I love your show, and I love it when my listeners say they catch your show and they love hearing me on it, so I do appreciate that.
Well, absolutely. And if you ever need me on, talk minor league baseball during the course of the season, let me know. Went to my first game last night, so.
Oh, you want to talk about the Braves? Minor league baseball? We'll have you on anytime.
Excellent. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, brother. Later.
Chad Dukes joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Took me a second to get the Braves reference because I'm an American League guy, but I did get it, and I'm a Red Sox fan. What can I say? All right, coming up, top of the hour, we've got news out of Maine to tell you about. I just saw a tweet by Justin Fenton, who is the crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He has since deleted this tweet. He was tweeting out something from the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. Breaking news just confirmed that final Justice Reinvestment Act passed last night included increase in second-degree murder penalty to 40 years. Justin Fenton's response was that the Public Defender's Office had warned that this could affect the willingness of defendants to cut plea deals. I asked Justin Fenton how many homicides right now in Baltimore are being plea bargained. I have not gotten a response. The answer, I'm guessing, is quite a lot of them. But, you know, again, when we talk about our deal of the day, these aren't always simple stories. There isn't always a, you know, one magic bit of legislation that could be written, one line of legislative text that could change all of this. You know, again, unfortunately, right now, if you are a criminal, you commit violent crimes, you manage to stay off the front page of the paper, you manage to not lead the nightly news, you're going to get those plea deals. And it's not just going to be for battery. It's not going to be for unarmed robbery. You're going to get a plea deal for armed robbery. You're going to get a plea deal for murder. You're going to get a plea deal for carjacking. As long as that case doesn't attract a lot of public attention, you're going to be able to skate with less time than what you were originally facing. And those reduced charges that you plead guilty to, you're not going to have to do every day of that sentence. And criminals know this. Career criminals know this well. They've lived it. It's their experience. So if this is a concern for the public defenders there in Baltimore County, that we're going to have, people are going to be less likely to take a plea bargain in these homicide cases, because now second-degree murder comes with a 40-year sentence. I got to be honest with you, is there any possibility, do the public defenders think there's any possibility that that increased sentence for second-degree murder might lead to, I don't know, fewer murders? We know they think it'll lead to more plea bargains. Do they think it'll lead to less homicides? Knowing that you're going to be, even if you do cop a plea, that second-degree murder charge means you're not going to be getting out of prison after 10 years or 15 years. You're going to be doing, if not 40, closer to 20. I'd be very curious to hear more of the thoughts of the public defender's office there in Baltimore about the proposed increase in penalties for second-degree homicide. Again, keep in mind, city had a soaring homicide rate last year. This year seems to be a little bit better. It's far from normal. All right, hour one is in the history books. Hour two straight ahead. Stick around. We have more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this quick timeout.
All the introduction to you. Good to see you, my friend.
That's good to see you.
You know, we've of course talked to you about your fabulous book, Hands Off My Gun.
Yeah, you guys have been so kind to me about this book too, so thank you so much for that.
Talk about this for people who hadn't heard about it and who haven't read it, who haven't bought it yet. What is in this book that that should make them buy the book?
Well, there are a lot of people on Facebook, and they argue with really uneducated people who, God bless them, they've been able to defy the evolutionary process and pick their knuckles up off the ground and peter out little arguments against Second Amendment rights. But what this book does is it shuts everybody up, all those annoying people that you want to argue with on the internet. Everything that you've ever wanted to know to shut them up is in here.
Yeah.
That's my elevator pitch. Everything that you've ever wanted to know about criminal statistics, about how the Second Amendment was created, what the founding fathers intended, even how long the Second Amendment was debated,
right,
where it came from, goes back to Magna Carta, everything. Everything is in this book. Everything. Literally everything.
You know, yesterday you had Rick Perry on, and we grabbed him after you were done. You moved from Missouri to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Governor Abbott, who's a phenomenal governor himself.
Two-way.
When you look at him as a governor, and you look at even just the tweets and just the tweaking he does and what he's done for the state, and then you look at a governor like Cuomo or a Governor Brown, and people talk about people moving to Texas in droves, and even just the governor's Twitter account shows why people on our side of the aisle are just getting U-Hauls like crazy, like you, and getting the hell out of where they are and going down to where you are.
I would say something so politically incorrect in comparison between Greg Abbott and Cuomo, but I'm trying to get right with the Lord. It's the new year. So, you know, I'm going to keep it nice.
Yes.
But probably everybody knows what I was going to say anyway. I think you can kind of get it. No, Texas is great. I mean, in St. Louis, it sucked. I mean, it was strictly becoming, very quickly becoming strictly an anti-Second Amendment town.
Yeah.
Even though the crime rate was sky high, the mayor and the police chief and everybody, you know, they really wanted to, they wanted to infringe on your rights. All my family are from the Ozarks. They're from Southern Missouri. We don't want any business with KC or STL. They just want to do them. You know, just leave us the hell alone.
Right.
And quickly, Missouri is becoming dominated by St. Louis, Kansas City, and then we have our very liberal governor, Jay Nixon. Mm-hmm. I could talk forever about
him.
That's
a whole show.
And when we moved, because not a lot of people in St. Louis, there are not a lot of conservatives in the city, or in the county. Not a lot of people liked us there. And we had people coming to our house, people giving us crap. When we moved to Texas, I don't know if you've seen The Burbs with Tom Hanks, but we were sort of like the Klopex for a little bit. Because we didn't know, people were nice to us, and we did not know how to react to that.
Right.
Like, we were so used to people just, like, screaming at us randomly if we would go out to eat.
Yeah.
And so, like, the very first time there was a neighbor that parked their car in front of my house, and I went into immediate, I've taken situational awareness classes, surveillance detection. I immediately went into my perimeter check mode, circled the car, got the plates, ran the plates, you know, and our neighbor, who knows, you know, they're everybody on our street's conservative. There's like more firepower on my street alone than in the entire city of St. Louis, criminals in St. Louis included.
Yes.
And my neighbors came over and they're like, no, it's just our son. It's just our son. He's home from college and that's just his car. And I was like, I'm sorry. You guys are nice. I don't know how to deal with you. And that's kind of what it was. I mean, people smile at you. And I would go into like the grocery store, especially now that we have open carry.
Yep.
What? I love the fact that I don't
but
have
you don't
to get excited.
Go to ATV, right?
Hell no. I don't go to any place where they're like, I'm sorry, we would like for you to become a victim before you can come and buy our groceries. Ew, no, I'm not going to do that.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzle. It starts right now. Jay Caruso riding at the Federalist joining us a little bit later on in the hour. Also, Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum joining us with a nanny state update. Another problem that Julie has found with a bit of journalism. I got to say, I'm kind of with her on this. In Maine, Governor Paul LePage announcing that he has signed legislative document 1572 into law. This goes into effect 90 days after the Maine legislature adjourns. This is the housing bill that we've been talking about in Maine for a number of months now, authored by Senator Andre Cushing of Penobscot. It would prevent public housing authorities from adding provisions in rental agreements that would ban the lawful ownership, use, possession, bearing, or transportation of firearms by tenants. Now, going back to the mid-1990s, the NRA fought a legal battle in Maine that got rid of the prohibitions on legal gun ownership in government housing. This bill goes one step further than that, and it talks about subsidized housing. If you receive federal funds as a landlord, you should not be able to set those conditions that deprive people of their constitutional rights when they are living there in that apartment or in that home. Harvey Limbo, who is a Maine resident, lives in subsidized housing, a disabled American, a repeat victim of burglaries. I think burgled four times. He bought a handgun. The day after he bought it, two guys broke into his house while Harvey was there. Harvey defended himself from those two intruders, but then the landlord tried to evict Harvey because the landlord had that no guns policy. And it didn't really matter that Harvey had acted in self-defense. Harvey had to go. So hopefully situations like that don't happen anymore with the signing of LD 1572 there in Maine. We are glad to see this resolution here. And I hope that, I hope that Harvey Limbo is aware of the impact that he has had for standing up, not only fighting for his life, but for fighting for his rights as well there in Maine. Also, this afternoon, keeping our eyes on some additional legislative news. We were talking about campus carry in Texas with Antonia Okafor last hour. That is not the only state where campus carry is still an issue. Of course, down in Georgia, Governor Nathan Deal still has House Bill 859 as well as the omnibus gun bill on his desk. So here's another reminder. If you're a Georgia gun owner, make sure you are still in contact with Governor Deal's office. You don't just have to call or email once. You can let him know that you're still paying attention to this issue. In Alaska, lawmakers there are moving forward with campus carry legislation as well. First House Committee passed campus carry legislation. The second House Committee is scheduled to hear the bill this afternoon, 1 p.m. Local time there in Alaska. It's Senate Bill 174. It would allow students, faculty, and guests to own, possess, carry, transport, or store a firearm on areas of the University of Alaska campus where they are not prohibited by law. Legislation would limit the Board of Regents' ability to regulate the possession and carry of firearms on campuses at the University of Alaska. And again, this has passed out of its first committee, the House Education Committee, and now goes before the House Judiciary Committee in Alaska. We will keep our eyes on Senate Bill 174 as it makes its way
through the legislative process. Have not heard of any professors yet who are threatening to leave the University of Alaska if this happens, if this becomes the law of the land there. But we've seen that again in Texas and down in Georgia. In North Carolina, WREL reporting no suspects in custody after a robbery on campus there at the University of North Carolina. You also had a robbery on the campus of Western Washington University yesterday. Cameron, Western Washington University, that was the campus, I know it's so hard to keep track of them all, but wasn't that the campus that wanted to establish a new college of, like, social justice, and it wanted $50,000 to throw a party for that? That was Western Washington, wasn't it?
It could have been. You're right. It is impossible to keep up the lists of demands. I'll Google it, but it sounds about right.
I want to say that it was Western Washington. Here, self-defeating radicalism at Western Washington University. Here we go. Oh, the Student Assembly for Power and Liberation. The list of demands. They want to have a College of Power and Liberation. Like, you know, you have a law school, College of Law, College of Medicine. A College of Power and Liberation. That was one of their demands. They had a lot of sub-demands within that that one demand, including, let's see, a yearly student emergency fund, work-study positions for at least 20% of students enrolled in the college, and a quote, minimum of $50,000. That was it. Minimum of $50,000 from the university to put on an opening event that will introduce the college and its mission. The event will be structured as a symposium, bringing together eminent scholars from the interdisciplinary fields that have grown out of social justice movements, marking the beginning of the momentous history of the College of Power and Liberation and the reemergence of a serious commitment to ethnic and gender studies on Western Washington University's campus. They wanted an office for social transformation. This would be a paid student committee that would be established there. All kinds of sub-demands for this new committee. They want mandatory online surveys conducted by faculty and administration that would allow Western Washington University community members to confidentially express concerns of discrimination and safety. Well, it seems like one student there at Western Washington publicly talked about feeling unsafe after she was robbed there on the campus right outside of a residence hall. Partial description provided, but no leads apparently on that robbery there at Western Washington. Catonsville, Maryland, attempted armed robbery reported on the Community College of Baltimore County campus. Yeah, again, these stories, they're not hypotheticals. And these are, you know, relatively minor offenses. Again, if you're the victim of a robbery, you might disagree with that description. But they happen all the time. There is not a day that goes by that you can't find a story from several college campuses where you've got students who are robbed, either on campus, right off campus. By the way, the Dallas Morning News, you know, we were talking about the University of Texas at Austin. The Dallas Morning News's Lauren McGaughey says the University of Texas on-campus gun policies will remain unchanged after that murder. Gregory Fenves, the president of UT Austin, said, "We are continuing to implement the campus carry policies that I announced in February, and I don't see any changes in those policies. Our goal is to make the campus safe for everyone." Now, there was no indication that anybody was actually calling for any changes. Again, the new law in Texas, the campus carry law, goes into effect in August. I haven't even seen any quotes from Gun-Free UT urging, you know, any sort, I mean, beyond the normal urging of changes there. Meanwhile, on the University of South Florida campus, the local student paper there, the Oracle, has a column by a student on the disturbing new trend of campus carry. The author here, Breanne Williams, says, while some believe concealed carry on campus only allows students to protect themselves in an emergency, it would realistically cause more harm than good. She says, senseless violence is sadly considered the norm in today's society. People have to be on guard when going to the movie theater, shopping, or even walking into a health clinic. Would arming students decrease the harm that a shooter with a premeditated plan could unleash on a campus? Probably, she says. Probably. But, she says, the reality is it could also create an environment with an increase in rash, spontaneous shootings. And here we go again. If a student becomes angry with another student or faculty member, he could easily discharge a round in a matter of seconds in a fit of rage. This will, without a doubt, alter the atmosphere of learning on every campus where concealed carry is a norm. Under campus carry, she writes, the University of Houston's Faculty Senate warned professors to, quote, be careful discussing sensitive topics, drop certain topics from your curriculum, not go there if you sense anger. This columnist, again, doesn't bother to talk about what has happened in states where campus carry has been the law. This student journalist, see what she's majoring in, mass comm. So she wants to be a journalist. And what she's done is she's taken a little nugget of information that she's probably read somewhere else. Maybe one of the professors there in Texas or the college professor in Georgia. I'm really worried about this. Regurgitated that opinion. Again, not even a fact, that opinion. And this is a column, so you are entitled to your opinion. But generally, you know, you want your opinion to be based on something of substance. And this isn't. Because, and by the way, you know, I don't mean to pick too much on this student journalist, because we've seen people who've gotten their degree and have been journalists for a number of years who, again, ignore states like Utah and Colorado, where concealed carry has been on the books for over a decade, in favor of presenting hypotheticals about what could happen when a law like this goes into effect, as opposed to actually looking at what has happened when a law like this went into effect. She says, Breanne Williams does, the author of this piece at the University of South Florida Oracle, if universities are truly concerned about the safety of their students, the answer is not to allow thousands of guns on campus. Instead, they should seek methods to better arm and train the university police so it can successfully handle threats such as active shooters on campus. Well, look, if you want to better train and arm college police departments, great. But you're never going to get to the point where the college police department, or frankly, after you graduate from college, and you move on into the real world, you're never going to get to a point where there's going to be a police officer for every man, woman, and child. You're never going to get to that point in society where law enforcement says, listen, we have erected this impenetrable barrier around every law-abiding person here. We can take care of it. And frankly, you talk to rank-and-file members of law enforcement, and they'll be the first ones to tell you that. So here you have the author of this piece saying, listen, would campus carry save lives if there was an active shooter? Yeah. But I think that those same people would be, you know, they'd just be so filled with rage randomly that some of these concealed carry holders would just get into arguments with people there in class. And the answer is to better train and arm the police. By the way, this may be the only college person in America, Cameron, who is writing that the police need to be more heavily armed.
Yes. What's the name again?
Breanne Williams. Breanne Williams. They're at the University of South Florida. Might be the only college student right now who's making that argument.
Trophy is being made.
Strange positions you find yourself in when you find yourself adamantly opposed to individuals being able to exercise their right of self-defense. Because I haven't read anything else by Breanne Williams. Maybe this is a common theme. But a lot of what we are hearing from the opponents of campus carry, particularly when those individuals are part of the broader coalition on the left, you will also find concern about over-policing, will you not? You will also find a great deal of concern about, in fact, I think, you know, in many cases, you might find more concern. Certainly look at Hillary Clinton. You'll find more concern expressed by Hillary Clinton for what police officers are doing in high-crime neighborhoods than what criminals are doing in high-crime neighborhoods. Because Hillary Clinton doesn't want to talk about what criminals are doing. She'd much rather talk about the police. She'd much rather talk about law-abiding gun owners. She'd much rather talk about the NRA, the quote-unquote gun lobby, gun manufacturers. Just don't talk about the actual people committing the violent crimes. Perfect example of this, again, is Hillary Clinton's bashing of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, but particularly using it to bash Bernie Sanders, who voted for it, saying that Bernie Sanders cares more about standing with gun manufacturers and not with the families of murdered children. That's how Hillary Clinton is putting it. Now, Jay Caruso at The Federalist has a piece on the folly of suing gun manufacturers. We'll talk with Jay about it right after a quick timeout. Stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this. Welcome on set. Our friend Melissa Bachman, the host of Deadly Passion on Sportsman Channel. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I wish I could be there in person, but unfortunately the winter weather is not cooperating with us. So tell me, what's going on in your world? What are you working on in 2016?
Well, right now I just got started on season 5, and I'm really excited about this season. We've been on the air for quite a while now, season 5, but one thing that I actually brought that's brand new that I've been trying to brainstorm for several years is a new segment called Memory Chase, and that's all about trying to get more kids involved. And the reason I did it is I wanted viewers at home to have a chance to send in their kids' footage. I remember when I was little, I used to look through our Outdoor News newspaper and look for photos of other kids, and then always want to submit mine. So it's kind of the same idea. So what I'm doing is about a minute and a half segment for those kids who get picked, and then their footage can be on TV. They get a huge prize pack. Just a really good way to get more kids involved.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And again, I mean, reaching back to your own childhood, we know that, look, we know that bringing kids into the world of the outdoors is critical. And it's not just critical for the industry, it's critical for the next generation. You know, I as a father of 5, I want my kids to understand that there is a world beyond the TV screen and their tablet. You know, I want them to get out and enjoy the great outdoors. And unless we actually help them, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. The TV's right there. The tablet's right there. It's so much easier to just stay on the couch, but it's so much better to actually get outside.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do is really bridge that gap. You do have so many kids on YouTube. You've got them online. You've got them watching the television shows. So use that medium to get them outside. So that's kind of been the idea behind it. I also know we don't have to give kids prizes for everything, but it doesn't hurt either. So a new bow, all sorts of great stuff. Plus they get to see themselves on TV. We've had a lot of submissions since it started. The first 5 were amazing. It's just really neat for anybody to see that real reaction from the kids, and it makes, you know, other adults excited and kind of reminds us to do our part as well to get out there and to bring kids along.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day and half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Pohl. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much for tuning in. It is your first source for Second Amendment information and some news there as well, and a little bit of opinion and analysis. It is NRA News, Cam and Company. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum joining us in just a little bit. But right now I want to welcome from the Federalist, Jay Caruso is with us. Jay, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program today, and really enjoyed your piece at Conservative Review, The Folly of Suing Gun Manufacturers. You say that it is amusing to watch Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders battle it out over firearms. This is like, it's one of the few areas where Hillary Clinton thinks she has some daylight between her and Bernie Sanders. She could talk up, you know, the great relationship she has with investment banks on Wall Street, but she really doesn't want to highlight that in the Democratic primary. So the woman who bashed Barack Obama in 2008 for going after the Second Amendment is now, in 2016, taking up the mantle of person who will go after the guns.
Yeah, Hillary is you know, her ship just kind of like reverses itself whenever it's necessary for her to do so. Gay marriage, gun rights, you know, Wall Street, it doesn't matter. And I said I'm loath to actually have to defend Bernie Sanders on these kinds of things, but hey, if she's wrong, she's wrong. And you know, wanting to file lawsuits against gun manufacturers for the actions of others who are using firearms is just it's ridiculous. It just makes no sense.
Well, you know, and again, I don't think Hillary Clinton really wants people to get into the details. You know, she's been you've got even the Washington Post fact checker says Hillary Clinton is wrong on guns. She's been blaming Bernie Sanders and Vermont gun laws for crime guns flooding into New York State. She's wrong about that. The liability argument that she sets up where, you know, she says that the gun manufacturers are the only industry in America where there's no liability for what they do and the products that they make. I mean, Jay, that's just bananas. That's just absolutely false.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely false. The Vermont lie is one of her biggest whoppers. I think there was something like 55 crimes or something committed in New York.
Not even 55 crimes, just 55 firearms that were traced.
Ah, 55 firearms. So it wasn't even crimes. Okay, so 55 firearms. Right. And then on the liability front, she makes it seem as though the gun manufacturers are completely free from any claim of liability. But that's not the case. People are protected in cases where the gun is not doing what it's supposed to do. If I fire, you know, if I shoot and it blows up in my face for whatever reason, then the gun manufacturers absolutely can be held liable for something like that. But Adam Lanza
took a Bushmaster rifle and used it to kill people, that's not Bushmaster's fault. They don't have – there's no liability there. They didn't do anything wrong. How many people own those types of rifles across the United States that never commit a crime?
Well, the argument that in the case of the murders at Sandy Hook and the families that have sued here – their argument is that, well, listen, these guns shouldn't be available, Jay. These guns belong in a battlefield, not in the hands of civilians, and that the company was negligent in even manufacturing these rifles, much less marketing these rifles to civilians. You know, there have been, again, a number of articles in places like the Washington Post that kind of politely point out that that legal argument is not likely to stand up to scrutiny. If it did, of course, we'd be talking about sweeping changes, not just for the firearms industry, but for manufacturing and commerce in the United States. You know, Jonah Goldberg, I don't know if you saw his tweet yesterday, but he said this is the same legal theory. Like, you know, if you hurt somebody with a G.I. Joe suing Hasbro,
right.
You know, no, they're you can't do that either. Yes, toy companies have liability laws. Firearms manufacturers do fall under liability laws. What is so sad, though, is that Hillary Clinton is so willing to lie about this. She's so willing to appeal to those low-information voters who are not going to be looking up court cases. They're not going to be looking up the legislative text or the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, because this is how she thinks they win.
Right. And I mean, let's be honest with you. The lawsuits that they want to file against gun manufacturers is just an end around everything everywhere else where they've been beaten. They've been beaten, you know, on the issue of whether or not Second Amendment protects the right of an individual to own a firearm. It does. In the Heller decision, that's been decided. You know, you have states that are now extending rights. You know, I think it was West Virginia was one of the most recent ones that says, you know, you don't need a permit to carry anymore. You can open carry. You can conceal carry. Vermont is the same way, and the states are going in that direction. More and more people are purchasing firearms, but yet violent crime, for the most part, we're still at a 40-year something low of violent crime. So despite so many people buying more firearms or purchasing more firearms, we're a safer nation overall. I mean, I think media attention has given rise to so much of these violent incidents that it makes it look a lot worse than it actually is. But the fact is that they want to use that. If they can't win in the legislatures, if they can't win in Congress, if they can't win in courts, they're figure out a certain way to do it. And so going after them with lawsuits, trying to shame Congress into repealing the law that protects the gun manufacturers from these ridiculous lawsuits is their next step.
Yeah, and, you know, the other important thing that Hillary Clinton certainly doesn't want to acknowledge this, but the reason why we have the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, Jay, is because back in the mid-90s, during the Clinton administration, Hillary's husband and the administration were fully on board with this strategy of trying to bankrupt gun manufacturers by filing junk lawsuit after junk lawsuit. And if they got that big tobacco industry payout, that'd be great. But even if they didn't, these are fairly small companies, all things considered. We're not talking about GM or Ford or Apple or Amazon or Google. You can, you know, death by a thousand cuts. You can bankrupt a company by dragging a lawsuit out. So this was a strategy, and we had dozens of states around the country adopt the state version of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act before it even got to Congress. And then 5 years after the bill was first introduced in Congress, Congress finally passed that bill, again, in response to something that was taking place, something that frankly got started in the Clinton administration.
Yeah, and you make a good point about the size of these gun manufacturers. I mean, we're not dealing with Walmart or ExxonMobil or companies that size. These are not billion-dollar-a-year industries. You know, it's still a relatively small industry when you think about it compared to others. So when you have the power of the federal government, let's face it, when they can file lawsuits, they have a blank check. And they can just continue to go after people and go after people and go after people. And you're right. It's a way to kind of, you know, if we can't even get the decision that we want, we'll just bankrupt them by constantly filing lawsuits against them.
It's lawfare. Our friend Kurt Schlichter has written about this. In fact, I think he's got a piece today talking about encouraging this. You know, fine, if this is how you want to play it, well, let's start fighting back. And we're seeing this with, you know, the subpoena of the donor records of the Competitive Enterprise Institute over the allegations. There's some sort of, you know, fraud involving climate change denialism This is another example of that lawfare, right? Where you're right. You don't get the legislative remedy you want. You can't get a bill for a anti-gun president to sign. So what's the next best thing? We'll just turn to the courts. And if we don't turn to the courts, by the way, we'll turn to regulatory agencies. And we'll bypass the legislature, we'll bypass the executive, we'll bypass the judicial branch, and we'll deal directly with the bureaucracy and the regulatory agencies to try to make life miserable for gun owners.
Oh, absolutely, because that's where they'll go, because there's not much you can do at that point, because the regulators, you know, they can look at a law or they can look at something and very broadly it can be defined and say, okay, we're going to apply this. Or, you know, even at the very least, if they're trying to remain under, you know, trying to remain within a court ruling, they can still make it very difficult. We still see this in D.C. with people who are trying to get carry permits. It's nearly impossible for somebody to do it, even though it's legal in a sense. But the steps that people have to go through in order to do it, they have to prove in some way or another that there is a threat to them, that they actually have to have it. They can't just do it because they have that protection under the Second Amendment.
You know, we will never see this question asked of Hillary Clinton, Jay, but given that violent crime in this country is at 40-year lows roughly right now, drug overdoses are at an all-time high, would Hillary Clinton endorse the idea of suing drug manufacturers for overdose deaths?
No, absolutely not. And I pointed out in my piece that she's also not going to go after, you know, beer makers or, you know, liquor manufacturer, wineries, or anything like that. I mean, we know that Hillary likes to imbibe from time to time as anybody else. Yet there's over 10,000 related DUI related deaths every year in this country. How come nobody's suing how come nobody's suing liquor stores or suing the alcohol manufacturers? Because it's not a demographic or it's not an area that's politically viable for them to win in. So, and they can't exploit it. So there's no reason to do it.
Talking again with
it.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. But unfortunately, see, this is where reality kind of comes into play here. If Hillary Clinton's legal theories and if the anti-gun legal strategies actually, you know, were enforced, if they won out, it wouldn't simply impact the firearms industry. This would apply to all kinds of companies and all kinds of industries here in the United States.
They don't look at the consequences of their actions and what could happen down the road. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if it's going to apply to gun manufacturers, then why can't it apply in anywhere else for any other thing? You know, can we sue Henkel now for how many? There are more stabbings. There's more stabbings every year, stabbing deaths, than there are people who are murdered with rifles. So are we going to sue knife manufacturers next? Is that next on the list?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, why not at this point? You know, all you have to do is look at what they're doing in England right now, where they have their anti-knife campaigns, and you've got chefs calling for an end to pointy knives in kitchens. I mean, like, you know, life is imitating the onion in many of these regards. So why wouldn't you carry it forward to that regard? Actually, heck, Jay, you can look at what they're doing in New York City right now, where they're going after people who own, you know, pocket knives. Charging them with illegal possession of a weapon and, you know, in some cases, you know, offering them 3.5 years behind bars for that crime.
I used to carry around a Swiss Army knife when I was 8 years old. What is the country coming to?
Yeah, well, good news is, Jay, we got a lot of folks out there who are still willing to fight, and I appreciate you coming on the program. It was good talking with you, sir.
Oh, Cam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Jay Caruso, you can check out his latest piece again, A Conservative Review, on Hillary Clinton and her lawsuits, or her defense of these lawsuits. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up in just a little bit. Also next hour, Charles Cook of National Review on the record numbers of firearms being purchased by Americans, as well as Hillary Clinton's comments, again, about the liability of gun manufacturers. Bethany Boer, the John Cardillo Show. Her college making the entire campus a free speech zone. But when we come back, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, stick around. We've got more NRA News Company, NRA News Cam and Company on the way right after this.
I'm speaking with Annie Bianco, better known as Outlaw Annie with the Cowboy Mounted Shooting Association, CMSA. Annie, so good to talk to you again. Welcome back to NRA News. And for those who don't know,
What is the CMSA?
CMSA is the Cowboy Mounted Shooting Association. It's the fastest growing equestrian sport in the world. But the reason I'm on your show is because we're shooting guns off these horses.
So tell us a little bit, how did this all start and then how does it work?
Well, it all started, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary. So it started, 20 years ago in the desert of Arizona. A man named Jim Rogers, who is our CEO, chairman of the board, he was actually out on his horse shooting targets off of his horse and said, wow, wouldn't this be cool to make it a actual competition? And obviously, since then, it's grown. You know, we're up to about 13,000 members. We're in arenas all over the country and now in Europe. So shooting blanks, though, obviously, because we wanted audience friendly.
You know, it always helps to take good care of the audience.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's how it started. And Annie, isn't it crazy to think of starting from him out on his horse shooting targets to where it is now? That's awesome.
It's mind-boggling. And in the 17 years that I've been doing it, we were, some of the first competitions, I mean, we were out there at the Ben Avery shooting range in the desert, running around cactuses, shooting these targets, and now we're in these major arenas across the country. I mean, Houston, and we just got back from Las Vegas. I mean, air-conditioned, gorgeous arenas, so we've definitely come a long way.
It's like, I'll be in my trailer, and my horse will be in his or her trailer, if you need them. Just kidding, of course. But
exactly.
So, explain, if you could, for me, the appeal. I mean, obviously, it looks like a heck of a lot of fun you guys are having. Why do you think it's so exciting for people to watch?
I think it's exciting because it definitely brings back, the spirit of the old West, even the Roy Rogers era, people are dressed all fancy and they're on looking sharp on their horses with their six guns, shooting these targets, beautiful horses, beautiful outfits. It's definitely, has some romance to it. But yet it's gotten very exciting because now it's really, truly become a huge equestrian sport where there's a lot of speed involved. There's a lot of skill. Just like race car driving, you're going to have some good wrecks. So it gets very, very exciting to watch now.
Speaking with Outlaw Annie Bianco with the Cowboy Mounted Shooting Association. All right, so people come and watch, obviously, but I'm sure you don't mind, you like people who want to kind of participate too, right?
Definitely. That's the whole goal, is get new members, right?
Right. So tell us about that. What's the kind of progression? Do they ride first usually, or do they shoot first and they decide to try? How do they get into it?
Well, I think in the old days it was more shooters and they had to learn how to ride, back when it, kind of was with SAS and that whole group. But now, from what I can tell as a coach, I'm getting more riders and we need to teach them how to shoot. So, which actually is a little easier because it takes so many years to learn to ride a horse well.
Right.
And especially at high speeds. Whereas shooting, if you have some good instruction, you can pick it up pretty easy.
Right.
So that's basically what I'm seeing now. Really good riders that are coming in and learning to shoot. And then, my goodness, again, the speeds are incredible because you have someone that can really ride well.
That's cool.
And, yeah, it's really exciting.
And I'll tell you, it sure looks like, as we're getting ready for this interview and looking and getting a graphic on the phone graphics, Annie, it looks like you are having so much fun when you're doing this. It's no wonder it's so popular. All right.
Yeah.
So,
adrenaline rush, definitely.
Yeah, that's cool. So tell folks, okay, first of all, we'll get to in a little bit how to get more information, but tell them, folks, make your pitch any 20, 30 seconds here. Why should people either try this, or if they can't try it, come and watch it anyway? Why should they check out the CMSA?
Well, again, it's a safe gun sport that is like a feel-good sport. I mean, you go out there, you see these beautiful horses, great outfits, them shooting the single action 45s, it brings back a little bit of the spirit of the West, except with some very exciting like NASCAR type moments in there.
Awesome.
So very exciting.
So Annie, how can people get more information about the Cowboy Mounted Shooting Association?
More information about Cowboy Mounted Shooting is definitely on our website at cmsaevents.com. You can check out all your local events across the country and all our big championship events.
Annie Bianco, Outlaw Annie with the Cowboy Mounted Shooting Association. Thank you for what you do. You're a great ambassador for the sport. It's so much fun to talk to you and to watch you guys get out there and enjoy. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having us on NRA. We love the NRA.
Welcome back.
to NRA News, Cam and Company. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy coming up. Top of hour three, Charles Cook with National Review, Bethany Bora of the John Cardillo Show, and our unofficial college correspondent as well. Right now, they want to get to our interview with Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum. She joined us in studio for another Nanny State update. Once again, Julie is a little ticked off at some quote-unquote journalism that she's seeing out there. Take a look and a listen. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Doing well.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for coming in studio. And you've joined us in order to send a very important message here to Huffington Post. I'm glad that we can amplify this. Because this is a phrase, really, that, you know, I think America has not gotten tired of. Check your privilege, Julie,
yes.
is the message that you have for the Huffington Post. Oddly enough, I kind of agree with this statement in this context. So what's going on over at the HuffPo?
Yeah, so the Huffington Post, headed by Arianna Huffington, she's the founder and namesake of the Huffington Post. She just started, is supporting a new project at the Huffington Post where the children of famous people, media moguls and movie stars and big corporate heads, are going to interview their parents and then have some pay someone to ghostwrite. I mean, I'm sorry, write an article about their parents. So, it's just such a, it just reeks of nepotism and self-indulgence and self-congratulations, and you know, it's gross. And I also find it hilarious coming from a publication, online publication like the Huffington Post, which, you know, often carries stories about how people should really check their privilege. And I mean, isn't this the ultimate thing where Arianna's 30-year-old daughter is now given this little sort of pet project to do? She and her friends can interview her parents and have these articles up. So it's a little bit nauseating. And of course, the questions, the ones that have been produced so far, Melinda Gates was interviewed by her daughter. Arianna has been interviewed by her daughter, Christina, Richard Branson, and a couple others. So, I mean, again, these are just, I wrote a whole piece about this, and Christina's first piece, the piece that launched the Talk to Me series, was done by Christina Huffington, the daughter of Arianna. And it really, you know, of course it's just sort of softball questions, but really Christina does, mostly she talks about herself, not about her mother. So I sort of criticize that. And, you know, at the end, I'm just saying, look, of course this feature will be sort of popular with the American public, but not because we're actually learning anything. It's because it's another voyeuristic look into the life of the rich and famous. So, you know, might as well be spread in People magazine.
So here's the thing. Well, there's also, don't forget, there's the very popular Rich Kids of Instagram.
Oh, yes.
Feed.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Right. And the whole phenomenon. And so this is Rich Kids of HuffPo, is what this is.
Yeah.
And it's just in a different form. It's the same thing. I'm glad you mentioned how old Christina Huffington was, because I didn't want people to get the sense that, you know, Julie's beat up with these like 5-year-olds who are just, Mom, what do you do for a living? No, it's not that. We're talking about the grown children talking to their parents. And look, don't get me wrong. I love the idea. I love the concept of encouraging grown children to talk to their parents. I talk to my dad on a regular basis. He's going to be 90 this year. And we get past the typical dad, son, how you doing, how you feeling. And we've actually had some great conversations, over the past couple of years. So I strongly encourage that.
Yes. Well, but I mean, look, according to Christina,
highlight that. I mean, that's, you
well,
know, that's
no,
the thing,
I, that
you
is that is actually
rich and the famous.
They claim, Christina Huffington claims, that kids not talking to their parents is a major problem, and that this whole effort is sort of, you know, it's some altruistic effort on her part to encourage kids to talk to their parents. I wish I had my article. I'm sometimes better at writing than talking about it.
Can I quote for you?
Do you have it right there? It's the part where she talks about a typical conversation with her mom and dad, where she basically says, you know, I jump on the phone and I talk, and then at the very end.
Despite the
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, despite the frequency and intimacy of our conversations, I recently realized how much there is still left unsaid. I started noticing how many times our phone conversations about some problem I was having or some exciting news I'd received would end with me hurriedly asking, "And everything good with you?" before saying our I love yous and hanging up. I'm generally a pretty inquisitive person and tend to like asking questions more than giving answers. But with my parents, the conversation is undeniably tilted in the opposite direction. And as you say, then she scurries off to various therapists to figure out the puzzling problem. There,
right. Because she did in an earlier part of the article talk about how her relationship with her parents is just, you know, she just has to go see therapists all the time to figure it out. And so, you know, my point was you could try shutting up. I mean, you could try actually starting the conversation with how are you instead of, you know, instead of rambling on. I mean, she seems just completely unaware of these things. And again, I just don't. I think it's just super great that these rich kids are trying to help everyone talk to their parents. I just don't know if it's worthy of a benefactor like Arianna Huffington and a major feature in a major online magazine. It's just a little bit, you know, it's like the BuzzFeed piece. I'm really kind of enjoying criticizing journalism today. I mean, really? We need a major series of rich kids interviewing their parents. And again, it just shows how incapable these people are of having normal relationships. And again, you know, so Christina talked about how her, this just totally bizarre situation with her parents where she's completely self-centered and doesn't understand why, requires her to go to a series of therapists. And, you know, I feel like, and she says that her therapists have advised her that she needs to come up with better boundaries, parent-child boundaries, so that she can grow into adulthood. At which point in the article I say perhaps this is a good time to say that she's almost 30 years old. I mean, you know, at what point did she think that she needed to sort of grow into adulthood? So, you know, this is...
By the way, how does this work? I mean, sorry for interrupting, but how does this even work? How does writing for mom's publication help define those boundaries? I mean, like...
Well
she's
done.
She's ignoring the advice of... I suppose... Well, there is, as you say, people will read this, but they won't read this for enlightenment.
No.
They will read this because celebrities are the postmodern court jesters of our times.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they are.
Really
They're there to entertain us. And so entertain us. Let's read something that we can be snarky about it. I mean, look, they did their job, Julie, because you clearly were touched by what you read. And you'll be back for more.
I don't know how to use the word touched. I was so annoyed when I read this piece. So that is basically my attitude most days. I just am annoyed. But again, you know, I've seen some others. You know, Melinda Gates is talking about how she has both a daughter and a son, and she worries because sometimes she asks the son to take the garbage out more than the daughter. And she's worried if she's, you know, has certain gender expectations. Why didn't she ask the daughter? I mean, I would love these problems. I would love these things to really take up the time in my mind. But again, these features will be popular with people because again, it's a look into their, I would say in the Huffington, families, a slightly bizarre lifestyle and sort of interactions with each other. But again, the fact, the sort of nepotism on display here, you know, the self-regarding, you know, the self-satisfaction seems to be entirely lost on these people, which deserves a little bit of ridicule, I think.
I'm right there with you. To me, it's the same. Look, I mean, it really is. It's that same lack of self-awareness that saw a bunch of celebrities go to the Oscars protected by a lot of people with guns and then talk about how anti-gun they were.
Yes.
Right. On the one hand, you're right. It does get a little old pointing this out. And there does seem to be more of this going around. So I'm not sure how much good we're doing pointing it out. But we still need to keep trying because it is annoying, and it is vapid, and it is vacuous. And frankly, a vapid and vacuous society, bad things happen.
I mean,
society becomes vapid and vacuous.
It's not just that. You think about the offspring of these incredibly wealthy people, okay? And this young girl who's almost 30 thinks that her contribution to the world is going to be encouraging people to have conversations with their parents. I mean, there's just so much more good that could be done. And, you know, fine, but this to me, again, it does not deserve, a wealthy benefactor and a weekly series in an online magazine. And it just shows how, I think the youth of the mega rich are having a harder and harder time. And, you know, this is probably nothing new, but are having a harder and harder time sort of figuring out what life is about, the normal phases of life, what growing up is about, finding meaning in their lives. Whether you find a lot of offspring of children now, they immediately go into modeling. Some of them go into acting. I consider that a worthy profession, but there just seems to be very little interest in actually education, in learning new things, and in helping people in a meaningful way, not in these sort of stupid, vapid ways. We do not need an online series on how to talk to mom and dad. I mean, and again, as I said in the article, you know, millions of parents deal with self-centered children by explaining, you know, don't be so self-centered. You know, try talking about something besides yourself. Again, this seems lost on them. So I'm sure we'll see more of these. I'll be grumpy about it. And come in here and talk about it.
I'm sure. See, you don't need to go to a therapist. You've got Cam and Company.
I can't afford a therapist. Are you kidding? Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I'm glad that you could come here and vent. And in the meantime, you know, I don't know. There is I know this wasn't in Huffington Post, but you can go read Anderson Cooper and Gloria Vanderbilt talking to one another. There's another conversation. Down to earth. Down home, folks.
Thank
as we,
God
say.
That's out there.
Julie, enjoy the rest of your week. Try to enjoy the rest of your week. And we look forward to talking again soon.
Okay. Thanks for having me on.
Julie Gundlach of the Independent Women's Forum with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. I mentioned a little bit earlier in the program that I ran across a story from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier today. The story was about a state-run youth facility that apparently has some problems, and they're still sending kids there. Kind of buried in this story, though, there was another announcement. I think this was the mayor of Milwaukee, Mayor Flynn. I think maybe the police chief was even there as well. Talking about the violent crime in one particular zip code in Milwaukee, 53206. The mayor there said that a five-year average of homicides in this zip code, 53206, shows an average, again, five-year average of a homicide rate of 250 per 100,000 people. Now, the national homicide rate is 4.5 per 100,000 people. You look at 2014, that's the last year for which we have statistics available. It was in the zip code 53206 there in Milwaukee, a homicide rate of about 80 per 100,000 people. This is not new. The public radio station in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, had a story November 11th, 2014, why the predicted revival of Milwaukee's poorest zip code hasn't happened. Now, keep in mind, the mayor there, who I think recently just won re-election, has been for years saying, well, the answer here is more gun control. That's what we need, not just in this zip code, but across the city of Milwaukee, across the state, across the country. What we need are more gun control laws. That's what will fix this broken community. So WUWM had this piece again in 2014. They say around the turn of the 21st century, some thought Milwaukee's near north side was on the verge of a revival. Many political and business leaders believed that there were too many people living in the area for it to struggle indefinitely and that market forces would be instrumental in bringing the community back. Journal Sentinel, January 18th, 2000. Heart of City Beats with Opportunity was the headline. The article pointed to a report from the University of Wisconsin-Madison's or Milwaukee Employment and Training Institute saying that inner city neighborhoods needed a, quote, little TLC to remain vital. That's all they need, just a little TLC. Flash forward to 2014, and much of the area is still beset by struggle. The 53206 zip code in particular remains the most impoverished in the city. In fact, every economic indicator in a new study of the neighborhood showed things have gotten worse since the beginning of the millennium. How much worse? Well, let's see. The employment rate for working-age males between the ages of 20 and 64, the employment rate, not the unemployment rate, this is the employment rate, 36.3%. Less than half the Milwaukee metro average. And that rate has dropped significantly between 2000 and 2012. That's one economic indicator. Number of jobs in the zip code dropped 6% between 2002 and 2011. Poverty rate in 53206 stands at 47.7%. That's, again, as of 2014. That is up from 39.2% in the year 2000. Again, this is an area of Milwaukee that has been a broken neighborhood for a long time. And Tom Barrett has been the mayor there in Milwaukee since 2004. And things in the worst neighborhood have gotten worse while Tom Barrett has been spending his wheels calling for more gun control laws. We're going to talk more about this after a quick timeout. Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, is coming up right after this. So tell me about the tour that you have. This is launching in March.
Yeah, so every year we go from March to July. This year will be the same as that. We'll start out in Florida down at my home headquarters down there in St. Augustine, and we'll end in Bellingham, Washington. So I'll go up the East Coast through the Mid-Atlantic up into New England, cross the Midwest, the Plains, the Mountains, and then end up in the Pacific Northwest. I'll personally do about 30 stops with the tour vehicle, put on about 30 different classes, probably hit about 21 states, and then we'll have 9 other instructors. We may actually add a 10th other instructor this year that'll be doing classes. We'll have a total of 70 events under the Personal Defense Network training tour between March and July. And people can learn more about that at personaldefensenetwork.com under the training tab.
That is amazing. All right. If folks are looking at this and they're thinking, I want to bring this to my neighborhood next year. How do you select the cities that you go to?
You know, honestly, it's one of the big missions of the Personal Defense Network training tour is when I'm in that vehicle, you know, you think about it. If I had to get on a plane, if I had to pack everything up, if I had to fly to the middle of a small town in one of the plain states, you know, the quote-unquote flyover states, if I had to go to Nebraska to do a course for 3 people, nobody's making any money. It's almost impossible to do. The range isn't going to win. The people, you know, they're going to get the training. They're going to get the win. But as a business model, it doesn't work. But when I get in that truck and I commit to 4 months on the road, I can drive through those small towns and build what we call training communities. So we just get people that reach out to us. They find me on Facebook. They reach out to Personal Defense Network. They find me at icetraining.us. You know, I answer all my own social media, Personal Defense Network. We've got a whole staff that answers all the inquiries and all the customer questions. When somebody says, hey, we'd like to host a class, we do our best to either myself or one of the other instructors to accommodate that request. You know, we try to fit it into the schedule. We make it make sense for everybody. And even if only 3 or 4 or 5 guys show up to that first class, we know that next year it's going to be 8 or 10. And next year that same range or that same training facility might host 3 or 5 other instructors from around the community, not just Personal Defense Network contributors, but everybody that's got something good to offer in the personal defense, the self-defense, home defense, the protection side of the industry. Everybody's looking for places to train. So, you know, reach out. If you have that classroom or you have that range, if you have maybe that small gun shop, you thought, well, I could never get one of the Personal Defense Network guys to come out there, you'd be surprised. Reach out to us. Let us know. We'll try to work it out into the schedule.
How has your audience changed over the years, Rob, the folks who are calling you and signing up for these courses, has that group broadened over the past few years, or is it still basically the same type of folks you've been seeing all along?
Now, if you look at my company, if you look at ICE Training, you know, before the advent of the personal defense network era, which really started in the mid-2000s, what we were doing at the Valhalla Training Center, what I was doing was probably about 80% armed professionals. It was law enforcement, military, you know, some really high-end military guys, high-end law enforcement. We were reaching people who already had experience, and we were sort of starting to sharpen that point, right? Now, over 80% of our business is relatively new shooters. It's people that have joined the NRA. It's people that have subscribed to Personal Defense Network. It's people that watched our shows on the Outdoor Channel and said, you know what, I take this seriously. I want to seriously get prepared to defend myself and my family in a worst-case scenario. And really, that's what we're gearing towards. So instead of the next class that we come up with being, you know, the most advanced tactical whatever class for the high-speed operator overseas, the most recent classes we've come out with are really designed for what I call the base of the pyramid. The person who's in their 30s, in their 40s, hasn't really been a gun person, is new to the community, and their primary interest is personal defense. And that's really what Personal Defense Network is all about. That's what our communications is really reaching out to, is educating people that this doesn't have to be a lifestyle. You know, for those of us here at SHOT Show, this is our life. This is our passion. This is our commitment. Maybe we're enthusiasts. Maybe we're hobbyists with guns. Maybe we're recreational shooters. We're seeing a lot more people who aren't gun lifestyle people. Mm-hmm. They're just people interested in safety and interested in personal defense and interested in self-improvement.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Charles Cook of National Review, Bethany Bora, producer for the John Cardillo Show, college student, talking about what's going on her campus, declaring the entire campus to be a free speech zone. How about that? Well, we'll start with the First Amendment and hopefully work on from there. Now, we were talking about Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right before the end of the hour break, and I apologize. This was actually Chief Ed Flynn who was making these comments about the zip code there in Milwaukee, 53206, which has the worst violent crime rate there in Milwaukee. As a matter of fact, the Journal Sentinel story said that the zip code is well known for its high level of incarceration. For example, Talking Points memo back in 2014 had a story, how one Milwaukee zip code explains America's mass incarceration problem. What's fascinating is this Think Progress piece from 2014 doesn't talk much, if at all, about the violent crime that occurs in this community. Instead, they say, after initial sentence, ex-offenders find little economic opportunity available to them. Further restrictions to employment and citizenship cripple convicts for the rest of their lives. But nothing about the actual crime rate in the community. They do talk about a recidivism rate for ex-offenders. In 2007, they found the recidivism rate was over 50%, meaning these people get out of prison, they go on to commit another crime. They reoffend, they go back behind bars. Chief Ed Flynn there in Milwaukee, again, would love to say that the answer is to be found in additional gun control laws. But you look at this data. Again, the employment rate in this zip code, 36.3%. Poverty rate, 47.7%. On their way up, not on their way down. Mark Levine, who is the author of this study there at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for Economic Development, said that there was this idea that there were certain competitive advantages in geographic location and the density of the population in the zip code that could be the springboard to economic development. And he says certainly location's a factor, but it has to be combined with other initiatives that would maximize that locational advantage and link it to other regional development issues. In other words, a lot of the city officials in Milwaukee thought that it would fix itself, right? We don't have to really do anything. We just have to say we're going to do something. And sooner or later, it'll just fix itself. It'll get gentrified. Problem solved. Mark Levine says one of the other erroneous suppositions was that the area's aggregate purchasing power would inspire retailers to open up shop there. And he says people don't buy in the aggregate. He says obviously the community does not get together and say, as a community, let's buy a couch or let's buy groceries. He says, I think the city kind of dropped the ball on some of the other policy interventions that might have raised the economic profile of the neighborhood. Now, back in 2014, the public radio station there in Milwaukee said that the city has not been the only force trying to revitalize 53206. Community members have started initiatives themselves, including mentorships, special high school programs, and neighborhood associations. What's fascinating is that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel story today talks about one bright spot there in the 53206 zip code. There is one neighborhood where crime is down in this zip code. Just one. But there is a neighborhood where crime is down, and it's down actually quite a bit. 21% drop in the three-year overall crime rate in this zip code where things are getting worse. So what's happening in this neighborhood? It's the Amani neighborhood. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says that residents have formed associations like Amani United and Friends of Moody Park. There's the Golden Center and the Dominican Center for Women, serving as anchor institutions in the neighborhood, which is now home to a healthy clinic, or to a health clinic, an early childhood education center, a family resource center, and a renovated park. Tom Schneider, who is the executive director of the COA, says it was not an accident. When people start to feel a stake in their community, they start looking out for each other. They report crime instead of pulling the shades. You've got a neighborhood that has become empowered. That's what drops crime. Or at least one of the things that drops crime. When you actually get the community involved. When we talk on this program about anti-crime measures, the call-ins for gangs, for instance, the ceasefire model, where law enforcement, prosecutors, they identify the worst of the worst offenders. Who's the biggest problem that we have right now in terms of the gang activity in our city? What gang is the one that we are running into the most? What gang is beefing with others the most right now? They identify those, and then they go after the members of that gang, particularly the most violent offenders, those with the lengthiest record, those who are most likely to be committing these violent crimes. They start there. And they don't just bring them in to talk to cops or prosecutors. That's a part of the equation. But in order for that type of intervention program to be successful, and again, we're not talking about paying people not to commit violent crimes. We're talking about bringing in the worst of the worst offenders and giving them that choice. And the choice isn't, do you want to earn $1,000 by not committing a violent crime, or do you want to run the risk of being a part of the criminal justice system one more time? The choice is this. Do you want to be a part of the community, or do you want to go to prison? Do you want to be a part of the community, or do you want to have the full weight of the law thrown at you the next time you violate the law? No plea bargains, no sweetheart deals, just you and a lengthy sentence. And that message, again, isn't just coming from law enforcement. It is coming from members of the community. That we love you, but we're sick of what you're doing. We want to see you turn your life around, but you can't keep destroying our neighborhood. So if you don't want to turn your life around, you can't stay here. And we will not protect you from the police. We will turn you into the police. In order for that to happen, you've got to have at least a working relationship between community leaders and police. B, there has to be some faith on the part of the community that what they are saying will actually happen. Because if you live in one of these neighborhoods that has been ravaged by crime, you are well aware that you keep seeing the same faces over and over again. And unfortunately, in some neighborhoods, you are well aware that snitches get stitches, or worse. And that if you report a crime to police, and it is discovered that you reported that crime to police, that there will be repercussions, that there will be consequences. Again, in Milwaukee, in this zip code, in this Amani neighborhood, where you've actually seen a reduction in violent crime, what you have is a community that has come together, that again, feels empowered, that is now working with the police, but also working among themselves to make sure that the violent criminals in their midst know that their neighborhood is not a welcoming home to them. There is, by the way, in this story at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, absolutely no acknowledgement by any city officials that, again, the real work that it takes to bring down a crime rate, to really improve a neighborhood, to start to build something, as opposed to the decades of tearing down these neighborhoods. There's no recognition in this story from any city official that this is happening, that this is a good thing, or that their minds have been changed or swayed from their typical anti-gun agenda at all. And unfortunately, you know, we saw homicides rise in Milwaukee last year. Hopefully we do not see a continuation of that trend this year. And I'm glad to see that there is at least one neighborhood there in Milwaukee that so far is bucking the trend. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense. Jacksonville, Florida. News 4 in Jacksonville. An attempted robbery of a cell phone store on the west side of Jacksonville. Police say that Thomas Joyner entered the Metro PCS store on Blanding Boulevard about 8 p.m. Saturday night, pulled a gun on the clerk. The employer handed Joyner money and then pulled his own firearm, pushed the suspect's gun to the side, and fired at him, according to police. The employee told police the two exchanged gunfire and the suspect fell but got up and then left the store. Later Saturday evening, Thomas Joyner showed up at a freestanding emergency room on 103rd Street. He was taken then to the Orange Park Medical Center. As of yesterday, he remains under guard, according to News 4 in Jacksonville, while recovering from a gunshot wound. In July of 2013, by the way, there was an employee who was killed during a robbery of a Metro PCS store on North Main Street in Jacksonville. 3 years later, the suspect in that case, James Rhodes, is scheduled to go on trial. 3 years. Trial date set for August on charges of armed robbery and murder. Thankfully, the employee at the Metro PCS store there on Blanding Boulevard was able to defend himself during this most recent armed robbery. He is our hero of the day. The deal of the day from Washington State, I don't think we've ever used this media source before, the Bothell Reporter, the Bothell Kenmore Reporter, to be specific, with a story. This is both a deal of the day and it's also kind of a dumb criminal story. A tracking device tossed in the loot bag might have been the robber's undoing, says the Bothell Reporter. A masked man made off with nearly $50,000 from a Bothell bank vault back on March the 11th, but hidden in the cash was a device that could be tracked using GPS technology.
A security company began relaying the device's location to police. It was tracked to an intersection in Linwood, Washington. A Snohomish County Sheriff's deputy was stopped in the intersection around the same time. The deputy reported that he looked over at a Jeep Cherokee that was next to him at the light. Guy caught his attention, the driver, because he was kind of sweating, looked a little nervous. The man later identified as Stephen Downey was sweating even though he had gloves on. The Jeep didn't have a license plate. That's also problematic. So the deputy activated his lights, made a traffic stop. The 45-year-old allegedly raced off, didn't pull over, ended up in the parking lot of a grocery store there in Linwood, Washington, ditched the stolen Jeep, ran for the grocery store, police chasing after him. The 45-year-old suspect was seen stripping off of his clothes. He shed his jacket in a produce bin. He dropped a gun, knife, sheath, and belt in the frozen food aisle. Officers caught up with him, took him to the ground. The suspect in this case, Stephen Downey, recently charged with first-degree robbery with a deadly weapon. He pleaded not guilty. Trial scheduled for mid-May. Faces up to 15 years behind bars if he's convicted. According to the Bothell Reporter, Downey is a convicted felon with a lengthy criminal history. No word on how many felony convictions he has to his name, but the paper says he has 56 misdemeanors. 56 misdemeanor convictions or plea deals. Again, we don't know how many of those 56 charges were originally felonies that were allowed to be pled down to misdemeanor. But that's an awful lot of crimes. The dude's 45. When you have more convictions than years on earth, something's up. Both the reporter says he was last in prison in 2013 for property crimes in King County. And again, if he doesn't get a sweetheart deal this time around, he could be facing serious time this time. Now, our good guy of the day, a little bit different than our usual good guys, but Kyle Morgan, our technical director down here in Farmville, told me about this story earlier today and thought, well, this has to be a good guy story. In Detroit, Michigan, Bill Dugan was at the Tigers game, and he ended up catching a foul ball. Yesterday. Actually, he caught, well, let's see, he caught five foul balls in one game, which is pretty impressive. What's even more impressive is that Bill Dugan, who's 39, season ticket holder, who says that his previous record is eight foul balls per one game, four in batting practice and four during the actual game itself, broke his record yesterday. Every one of those foul balls he gave to a kid. And considering I just saw this little video clip, I don't even know where it came from, Cameron. Have you seen this? The woman snatching the foul ball out of the hand of the little girl and then proudly returning to her seat. Have you seen that going around today? It is, it's awful. It is good to see. A guy who is willing to give up a little bit. He said, not a big deal for him. After all, he remembers the first foul ball that he got. He said, my first foul ball that I ever got, my dad reached out with a poster, pulled it in, hit off of the Cleveland Indians, George Vukovic. And now Bill Dugan is giving back to kids in the area. So if you are attending a Detroit Tigers game near the walkway between sections 124 and 125, just to the right of home plate in Comerica Park, seems to be a pretty good spot to get a foul ball. Either you'll get it or Bill Dugan will get it. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return to the program, Charles Cook of National Review joining us on the show. Bethany Bora of the John Cardillo Show later on in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company right after this.
right, speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I'd served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're an American. That means you're free to defend your life. But Carol Bowne is no longer with us because the state of New Jersey denied her that right. When her convicted felon ex-boyfriend smashed her car windows, she got a restraining order. Despite having home security cameras and an alarm system, she feared for her life. So she applied for a handgun permit. More than a month later, and just 2 days before her death, she demanded an update. Her application was still processing. Carol Bowne didn't choose to be utterly defenseless when her predator stabbed her to death in her driveway 2 days later. That choice was made by the state of New Jersey. Government policies that deny us our right to defend our lives are not just ineffective. They are immoral. If you refuse to surrender your life to the dictates of your government, speak out. You can make a difference. The 5 million men and women of the National Rifle Association of America fight for you. We are freedom's safest place.
We don't rise up to the occasion, but instead fall back on our level of training. Champions spend hours practicing for the smallest improvements. In order not to be a victim, it's important that you have a plan.
That's the perfect time to take your shot.
I am Gabby Franco, and I'll see you next time in another episode of Tips and Tactics, sponsored by Cabela's Outdoor Fun.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Bethany Bora still to come on the program. Right now, I want to welcome to the show, I think for the first time since big news happened with Charles Cook of National Review. How you doing, Dad?
Thank you. I'm doing very well.
If Milo Yiannopoulos can call Donald Trump Daddy, I'll just call you Dad. How about that? It's already weird. It can just be a little weirder. Are you getting any sleep?
Yeah, the brunt of the sleeplessness is falling on my wife.
It always,
she's the only one who can feed him.
I understand. I know. But you make up for it in other ways, right? Or try
exactly.
to?
Exactly. I am able to lift him up higher than she is. And, we watched James Bond the other day, which she wouldn't have done.
Oh, good. Well, it's good you're exposing him to the classics very early.
Exactly. We watched Timothy Dalton, underrated Bond.
Wait. You started off with Timothy Dalton?
No. I started off with Connery.
Okay.
We were watching Timothy Dalton the other day.
All right. I was going to say, we're going to have words here, Charles. But all right. As long as you start him off
with
Connery.
Well, you know what's next is Red
Dawn. Fantastic. Let me know if you need to borrow my DVD.
Yeah, exactly. Got to be done.
So here's the next question. Have you bought your son his first firearm yet?
No, because that would be wildly illegal in Connecticut. I suppose I could buy myself one and then promise that at some point in the future it will be his, or even put it in a trust. But I haven't done that yet.
You have not. All right. Well, apparently you're one of the few Americans who have not bought a firearm recently because, as you point out at National Review, Americans do continue to buy firearms at a record pace here. I mean, every month, it seems, Charles, we are seeing a new record set for the month of March, new record set for the month of February, for January, right? I mean, and it's been like this for quite some time now.
Yes, and it's worth pointing out that it's new records atop new records, which is to say that when it is reported correctly that this year gun sales are up 36% over the same time last year, last year was pretty high too. And the fact is that Americans bought almost 8 million guns since January 1st. That means a couple of things. Firstly, it means that the predicted slowdown in purchasing has not come to fruition and seems unlikely to come to fruition, perhaps because Hillary Clinton keeps talking about gun control, perhaps because Americans are now in a habit. Also, if you project the gun buying patterns into the future, you see some pretty astonishing numbers. And it seems reasonable enough. I ran through the numbers on National Review Online, so if you want to know where I got them, please do look there. It seems reasonable enough to contend that there may have been 400 million firearms in circulation on January 1st of this year. We keep using the same number, 300 million, 350 million, but we've been using that number for 2, 3, 4, 5 years now, and we've been seeing 20 to 25 million guns a year sold. So even if you presume that all of the background checks yielded only one purchase and that there is a little bit of attrition, maybe 1-2% of the supply disappears or is put out of service, you're looking at around 400 million guns, maybe a little less. Well, if this year yields another 30 million sold, and if that trend continues, you're going to hit 500 million privately owned firearms by 2020. Now, I don't know how you start going about passing meaningless gun control measures with those numbers. I don't think they will get very far.
No, I don't think that they will, but, you know, that doesn't mean that they won't try.
They may try, and they may even pass laws. I'm not suggesting they'll give up.
Yeah.
But when you have that critical mass of firearms, which it should be said once again has coincided with a remarkable reduction in not only crime, but crime committed with firearms as well, when you have that many in circulation, it's going to become more and more difficult to do anything. It's already, in my view, largely futile to try. I think that by far and away the best way of addressing where problems do exist is to make sure that good people have guns. And clearly, because they are going through the background check system, and although I'm not wild about all facets of that system, the fact that somebody goes through it demonstrates that they're buying from a dealer in most cases. Good people are buying guns. People who don't want to hide, I should say, are buying guns. And if you believe in a robust and free citizenry, if you believe that rights need to be exercised or they cease to be rights, that's a good thing. I don't want to foist guns on anybody who doesn't want one. I don't want to mandate ownership. I don't want to make anybody who has a moral or ethical objection into an NRA member. But I also think when people choose to exercise their rights, and that's what's happening here, that's a good thing. It's a good sign.
I'm generally in favor, yes, of more exercising of rights. Obviously, though, Hillary Clinton has a very different point of view. Let's talk about her position when it comes to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. This is one of the areas where she's been, you know, trying to differentiate herself with Bernie Sanders, proclaiming herself to be the one true anti-gun candidate, unlike Bernie Sanders, who had that D-minus rating from the NRA once. And so yesterday, actually more than just yesterday, Charles, I mean, for a few days now, we have seen her say that Bernie Sanders is siding with gun manufacturers over the families of murdered children, that there is that the gun lobby or the gun industry enjoys these sweeping protections against lawsuits that mean that they can never be held accountable for their actions and what they do. And all this needs to change. We need to repeal the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act so that you can actually sue firearms manufacturers for the actions of criminals.
Well, the first thing to say is that she's lying. It is not the case that a gun manufacturer that produces a faulty product is immune from a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the case at all. What is the case is that if a gun manufacturer produces a legal product that is in good working order, they cannot be held responsible if somebody misuses it. The correct analogy here is with cars. If Ford produces a truck and the brakes don't work and its user piles into a crowd by mistake, Ford can and should be sued. But if Ford produces a perfectly legitimate working car and a murderous lunatic drives that car into a crowd deliberately, you cannot sue Ford for that. Hillary Clinton likes to use the example of toys. She says if you can sue a toy manufacturer for a faulty toy, why can't you sue a gun manufacturer when somebody shoots up a school? Well, they're not the same thing. If a toy is faulty, you can, of course, sue the manufacturer. But if a toy is in perfect working order and somebody uses it to hit somebody else, or even to kill somebody else, the toy manufacturer is not liable. Now, the reason that the legislation that Hillary Clinton would like to see overturned was passed in the first place was that anti-gun forces, having lost in the states, having lost in Congress, having lost in the court of public opinion, decided that their best bet would be to convince juries to rewrite the law and thereby introduce by the back door regulations and punishments that have not passed through any legislature or any democratic process whatsoever. And to his credit, Bernie Sanders joined in the vast majority of American manufacturing groups and a majority in the House and the Senate and agreed that, of course, you should be able to sue companies that make faulty products, but not those that do their jobs legally. And the precedent, that initiative, was nipped in the bud. That's a good thing.
Well, yes, I think it is a good thing. But so let me ask you this, because, you know, Hillary Clinton's legal theories here about how this should work. You mentioned earlier violent crime is at maybe all-time lows, but certainly at or near 40-year lows nationwide, and in many places across the country, it's even lower than that. At the same time, drug overdoses, Charles, are at an all-time high, right? Opioid overdoses, prescription medication, as well as heroin at an all-time high. So under this theory that Hillary Clinton is working with, why wouldn't you be able to sue? Why would not the family members of a drug overdose victim, for example, be able to sue pharmaceutical companies under the premise that, listen, you know that some of these pills are being redirected into the black market. Clearly, you're aware of this, right? Opioid overdoses have been skyrocketing over the last couple of years, and yet you continue to pump these pills out. So why would that theory not stop pharmaceutical companies from being sued?
Well, I think you're right. there's no reason whatsoever to draw a distinction between those two propositions. Now, I would say this. If Hillary Clinton thinks that pharmaceutical companies should exist under a liability, in other words, that they should operate knowing that if a certain portion of their output is funneled into illegal channels, and if that happens, that they should be prosecuted, then Congress needs to pass a law to that effect. It hasn't. And so for the Hillary Clintons of the world to propose that trial lawyers should attempt to convince juries to ignore what the law says and, voting purely on an emotional basis, smuggle in by the back door such a rule, I think is outrageous. There is no such liability applied to gun manufacturers. If Hillary wants one, she has to get it passed through Congress or at the state level. But she recognizes that's going to be difficult because it is preposterous to suggest that manufacturers that make functioning goods should be held responsible for those with evil intent. And so she's picking up one of the more cynical cudgels she has available to her. I would just quibble with your opening characterization of this as a legal theory. Hillary Clinton is not stupid. She is not a bad lawyer. I don't think she's a particularly great lawyer either. But she's not an incompetent enough lawyer to believe that this is a credible legal theory. When she says repeatedly, I don't understand why you can sue a toy company if the toy is broken, but not a gun manufacturer if the gun is misused, she does understand that. She's not telling the truth there. She's not genuinely confused. She hopes to mislead. She is deliberately playing upon emotion and ignorance. And I can't think of much more cynical behavior than that. And I will say a sentence you won't hear me say very often. One has to admire Bernie Sanders for his steadfast refusal to play ball. He said in an interview with the New York Daily News that had him on the cover under the disgraceful charge that he was disgracing the Sandy Hook victims. He said to that editorial board that no, he didn't believe that manufacturers should be liable when they hadn't done anything wrong, and that he would oppose any attempt to make them liable by the back door. I think you should be praised for that.
You know, it is interesting because I think over on the Democratic side, one of the problems for Hillary Clinton is that there's this authenticity gap, right? Bernie Sanders might be a self-described Democratic socialist, but he's also a self-described Democratic socialist, and there aren't too many politicians who would run for president as a Democrat who'd be willing to embrace that. You know, I think there are a lot of young voters who say that they're feeling the burn because Sanders is a more authentic candidate. And I got to tell you, Charles, you know, you look at how Hillary Clinton has been trying to use this issue throughout the campaign. You start with Martin O'Malley. He was the one who tried to differentiate himself from Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. He was going to be the one true anti-gun candidate. And it didn't really work out well for Martin O'Malley's electoral prospects. Hillary Clinton, as she has been trying to beat Bernie Sanders up over this issue, what's been going on politically? Bernie Sanders has won, what, 8 straight primaries and caucuses, while Hillary Clinton has been increasingly, you know, increasingly attacking him for his positions. Now, I realize New York State's a little bit different than Wyoming in terms of the electorate. But it is interesting to me that these attacks, at least up until this point, have not swayed Democratic voters in places where Hillary Clinton might be hoping to, again, sway an opinion or two.
Well, one of the reasons that she's run into a brick wall here is that the vast majority of the voters who are skeptical toward the Second Amendment on the left are already with her. The fact of the matter is that Bernie Sanders does extremely well with younger people, and Hillary Clinton does much better with older people. Younger people on the left are not as in favor of the right to keep and bear arms as I am, or as you are, for that matter. But they are more in favor of the right to keep and bear arms than middle-aged and older Democrats. In fact, if you look at the New York Times polling on assault weapons, so-called, the younger cohort in the respondents group was against a so-called assault weapons ban. More than 50% of, I forget what the cutoff point was, maybe 35. Well, a lot of those people are also interested in Bernie. And so if you are hitting Bernie dishonestly in an area in which younger people tend to be more skeptical of the government, I don't know how much hay you're going to make.
Yeah, an excellent point. Listen, Charles, unfortunately, we have got to run, but I appreciate you coming on the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you here in a little more than a month now.
Absolutely. I cannot wait. My first trip to Kentucky.
Really? All right.
Absolutely.
Well, have you figured out your transportation? You want a road trip?
I did think about that, Cam, but the logistics just don't work.
I know.
So I will be flying in.
All right.
We're going to go see some baseball.
We are indeed. Absolutely. All right, Charles. We'll talk to you soon, man. I appreciate you coming on the show today.
I will. I'll talk to you soon.
Charles Cook from National Review. Join us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Bethany Bora, producer of the John Cardillo Show. College student, our unofficial college correspondent. Join us talking a little free speech on college campuses. I think you're still allowed to talk about free speech on the college campus these days. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this. Right now, you know, we have a good guy segment on the program each and every day. Well, here is a real-life good guy. Major Ed Polito is with us from the Folds of Honor Foundation. Major, it's good to see you again, sir.
Man, what a great day to be an American.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm just excited. Look, at when you get to come here, this is freedom right here.
Right.
And you get to see all of the great things that are, all the great people, all the great items that are here, and certainly the hardware, man. I'll tell you what, it doesn't get better than that, and this is about the USA, baby.
Yeah,
in Vegas.
That's right. So tell me, if for folks who haven't been able to catch you on the program before, those few Americans out there who still are unaware of the Folds of Honor Foundation, what does this organization do?
Well, the Folds of Honor Foundation was started by Major Dan Rooney, and as a co-founder of the organization, I've been with Major Dan on this mission for about 8 years. We give scholarships to the families that have fallen and wounded, but we've awarded over 10,000 scholarships. This year, we'll probably do another 2,500 to deserving military families, honoring the sacrifice, educating the legacy, and providing healing and support for these wounded service members that come back and are disabled and that they need that hope and that support. And I think, you know, NRA News has been with us from day one, and, you know, we've got so many great sponsors that are part of it. Here just in the show, you know, Colt, Bushnell, got 511 Tactical down there. We're going to do a book signing at 2:30 this afternoon at the 511 Tactical booth, and we're just spreading the message about freedom and sacrifice and the Folds of Honor.
You know, and it's so important, especially for those of us who never wore the uniform and we never served. We have, I think, an obligation to help those who have. And, you know, I never wore the uniform, but my dad was in the Navy in World War II. My brother was in the Army during Desert Storm, was in Korea at the time. And I've lived around military families, and I've gotten to see firsthand not only how the soldier or the sailor or the airman how they are impacted, but how their entire families are making sacrifices each and every day. And when we're talking about our wounded warriors, you know, those families, they're going through so much that it's easy for us to forget, right? We don't see the news stories every day anymore about our soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan. In fact, our special ops guys, you know, they work very quietly. And
correct.
So we're not supposed to see the headlines, but they're there. And they are serving, and we need to serve them. So what can we do to get involved with Folds of Honor?
Well, people can go to foldsofhonor.org and get involved. They can also do a lot of buy the products that we have out here. The other thing I will tell you is that as you serve this great nation, and as I put on the nation's uniform, lost my leg, almost lost my life, I always think about, you know what, I did what I did to preserve freedom in this nation, and for all of us in this nation to have everything that we've got, to live and have a great quality of life. And you just explained that to us, to your listenership. You know, it's about honoring that sacrifice, but more importantly, about making sure that around the world that they know the United States of America is nobody to be messing around with. Because at the end of the day, our people stand up for freedom.
Now, okay, so to that end, I want to ask you something as Major Ed Polito, not with the Folds of Honor Foundation, but just Major Ed Polito for a second. How concerned are you that that America's enemies are starting to get a different message, that maybe we can be pushed around a little bit?
Well, I got to tell you that we cannot sit around and let people push us around. And I am a big advocate. In my book, Warrior for Freedom, I wrote about Ronald Reagan and his message to the world that, you know what, not only are you going to tear that wall down, but if you do something and you get out of line, we're going to bust you up. And I got to tell you, that's the way I look at things. You know, we cannot sit around in this world that's so negative with ISIS doing what they're doing. And then, of course, them kind of infiltrating our country and then this refugee problem and all of this. And our leadership, our poor leadership, not understanding that at the end of the day, it's not about saying that individuals can't come here and follow the American dream. It's about making sure that when you come here, you learn not only our language, our customs, but you live as an American. And I got to tell you, the culture, I'm Colombian and Puerto Rican. My father was an immigrant. I truly understand that the red, white, and blue shines bright because people like him, a Vietnam era vet, took that oath of office to love his country, to love his family, and to have faith in God. And I think that's the elements of who we are in this nation.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company.
All right, it is always nice to be able to close off the show with a little bit of good news. Bethany Bora, producer of the John Cardillo Show, our unofficial college correspondent, joined us on the program as well. Bethany, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. By the way, did I demote you? John referred to you as co-host today. Are you the official co-host now of the John Cardillo Show?
I'm occasional co-host. Frequent co-host, occasional co-host. We go back and forth.
You're moving up here. I'm telling you, it's going to be the Bethany Bower Show before long. So tell me what is going on your campus here. I mean, we've been talking a lot about free speech on college campuses for months and months now, and various universities have responded to demands from students in various ways, some good, some bad. What's going on where you're at?
But we actually had a bit of good news come out at FAU. I go to Florida Atlantic University. It's in Boca Raton, Florida, an area that's notorious for liberals because a lot of them live in Boca. And we had a resolution passed by our student government late last week that would eliminate our free speech lawn, because right now we have a free speech lawn, and it's the only place that you can do partisan political events. They would eliminate our free speech lawn and make the entire campus a free speech zone.
Wow. So this is coming from the students right now.
Right. It was passed by the student government, which is elected by the student body, and resolutions in our SGA, resolutions are used to express an opinion to administration on behalf of the legislative group, which is representing the students. So this is a policy proposal that's indicative of the opinions of the 33,000 students that attend FAU.
That is fantastic. Now, has there been any pushback, Bethany, from people who say, no, we can't have this? There's too much free speech. We got to restrict it to the lawn. In fact, can we restrict the lawn? Can we have like maybe just a free speech blade of grass where you have to stand?
A blade, that would be great. No, it's disappointing that we haven't had any feedback because no one even knows about it. I texted a few of my friends today who are engaged on campus and asked if they knew what the SGA resolution that passed was, and none of them knew what it was. I'm friends with the student who proposed this resolution, so I'm actually talking to him, and he's brought out a bunch of questions and answers for me, and we're going to put all of that out tomorrow. So it's in long form in an article, but no one even knows that this passed, and it happened almost a week ago.
That is amazing. That this, it's fascinating to me because sometimes, as you're well aware, Bethany, if somebody takes offense to something that is said on campus, we hear about that right away, right? And it doesn't matter. We don't have to be in the same state. We don't have to be a college student. We still hear about it right away. But when students take that opposing step to say, listen, we want free speech. We want to encourage free speech. We can handle it. There isn't any coverage. As a matter of fact, even the students on campus are unaware of this. That is fascinating to me.
Right. You look, and last week it was all over the news that a student senator at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga was asked to resign her post because she wrote the word Trump in sidewalk chalk.
Yep.
And you heard about that all week long, but you haven't heard about this one yet. And my concern with that is that administration is not obligated to do anything with this resolution. It's going to go up to their desk and say, SGA passed this, so this is a resolution that they're proposing to you. If no one hears about it and they don't hear from anyone about it, they can very easily just discard that resolution and do nothing with it. So people have to know about it and have to actually contact administration and express support for this if they want the policy to be implemented. If we just let it be, nothing changes, and this will just get passed under the rug like everything else does.
You know, and that's really important that information gets out there, because as you say, you know, clearly we're seeing a lot of these university presidents respond to pressure. And I won't even say it's public pressure. And, it seems like whatever group can speak the loudest, even if they don't have a lot of numbers behind them, but if they can agitate. And frankly, you know, look, let's be honest, Bethany, if you're there to get a college education, you don't want to be an activist, you don't want to be involved, you're not. You're not going to speak out, right? You're not going to stand up. Unfortunately, you know, this is one of the things, one of the problems with, you know, the left trying to make everything political, is that people who want to be left alone, ultimately, at some point, you can't. You can't be left alone. You have to stand up and fight for the right to be left alone. Is that kind of where we are right now?
I think that's where we're at. I think a lot of students, just like you said, they don't think it's going to affect them. They don't want to hold events on the free speech lawn, so they don't really care if we have a free speech lawn or a circle or whatever it is. But ultimately, when you look at it, it does affect all of the students on campus, because it affects the atmosphere and it affects the culture of learning that you're encouraging there. So even if you look at someone who's in the art department, it affects the type of art that you're learning and the conversations that you're allowed to have if you're encouraging an environment where opposing ideas can meet each other and be discussed and debated rather than kept in a closet and not allowed to be shared. So even a policy like this that maybe doesn't necessarily directly relate to every student still does affect them, even if it's indirectly.
Talking again with Bethany Bora from the John Cardillo Show. So, Bethany, you know, when you see this, all this kind of flying under the radar at your campus, does this give you, you know, again, I know we've talked about the downside of this, but on the other side here, does this give you a little bit of hope that maybe the campus protests are sort of running out of steam, that the news cycle is maybe moving on from this issue a little bit, and if there's not that attention given to the precious snowflakes, that the protests will sort of dwindle and dry up?
You know, I don't think that the protests are going anywhere, because I think that there's a certain group of college students that will always want something to be outraged about, and they will always find it. But I think this does encourage me to see that there are students, though, who are going to start fighting that trend, and they're going to start actually speaking out for common sense, if you could call it that, and just it should be normal that we can have this debate. And I think that what we're going to start seeing is more students who will speak out for that rather than be outraged about everything just for the sake of outrage.
Yeah. And I will say this, too. At the Ohio State University, there was a group of students who had apparently occupied one of the administration buildings. And they weren't leaving, Bethany. They had their demands, and we're not leaving until all of our demands are met, until the university said, well, you can be arrested. You know, you have until midnight to clear out, or we can arrest you. And all of a sudden, these students found somewhere else to be. You know, now look, there have been plenty of protests throughout history. Even recently, we saw 400 people in Washington, D.C. get arrested this week protesting. That's a thing that happens, right? If you're willing to stand up for your belief, it's called, I believe, civil disobedience, right? You're willing to break the law. You're willing to pay those consequences because what you're fighting for, you believe, is so important that your act of civil disobedience matters. We didn't see that there at the Ohio State University. And I wonder if it's because at the end of the day, as you say, a lot of these students, they're protesting to protest. Are they protesting really deeply held convictions that they are willing to go to jail for? Well, it looks like not at the Ohio State University.
And not in most places all over the country either.
Absolutely. So I don't know. I don't know if we're going to see more of that type of response from the universities, but I hope that was sort of a gut check for those student protesters to really think about, you know, what is worth fighting for? What is worth going to jail for? And apparently, you know, making sure that you've got some new committee that can investigate, you know, student speech. Ultimately, at the end of the day, no, that's not something that is worth jailing yourself for. But there are, I think, principles out there. There are things that are worth standing up for. Frankly, I think free speech is one of those principles that is worth standing up for. And I hope, you know, again, I hope that we're starting to see a turnaround here. I hope that the restrictions on speech are now starting to be met with those forceful displays. You mentioned the student at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, who was going to be ousted for her support of Donald Trump. You also have a counter petition filed by students. I think there are several hundred names now. They want a recall election of all of the student government leaders who sought to remove that student senator for exercising her political opinion. So we are seeing that pushback happen.
Yeah, there's a reversal happening. And as long as we make sure that those stories are heard, it'll continue. If they aren't put out there, then students are still going to feel afraid to actually speak out for it. As long as there's support happening, even just among college students with each other, I think you'll see that trend continuing. I think it's on its way back up.
All right. Well, listen, Bethany, we are almost out of time, unfortunately, but I appreciate you coming on the program. How much longer for class before the semester is over?
Like 2.5 or 3 weeks, and we're done.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Oh, to be a college student. All right, Bethany, enjoy the rest of your day. We will talk again very, very soon.
Thank you, Cam. Have a great day.
You too. Bethany Bora joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Tomorrow, we've got David Webb, host of the David Webb Show right here on SiriusX and Patriot 125. Also, another Dave Workman, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, joins us on the program. Tim Lee with a special midweek edition of the Liberty Update from the Center for Individual Freedom. Our friend Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us on the program as well. Of course, all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. It's all coming up right here on the next edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Thanks so much for joining us today. Be safe, have fun. We'll see you back here soon.